You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Flashpoints.
Guns and Butter.
Something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter is a live show here at KPFA, and I'm delighted to be here live, unusual for me to drive down today. I'm also excited because I'm joined by Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks, Bonnie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good to have you on again. We're going to be hearing a lot from Tony about the new Guns and Butter website and other developments. I did want to take a moment before we go to the first cut of our incredible premium. We're bringing you Barbara Honecker on her research into the Pentagon on 9/11. Very, very good stuff. Very thorough. So anyway, we're real excited to be here to support KPFA, to support the fun drive on Guns and Butter, and we're hoping that you will too. We're bringing you first a 20-minute cut from an incredible three-hour DVD, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't and Why It Matters, with Barbara Honecker. You know, Barbara Honecker has quite a history. She was part of the Reagan administration. She worked for Reagan's domestic policy advisor. Her office was right above the Oval Office. She was the first one from the Reagan administration to resign as a matter of conscience because of the treatment of women's rights. She went on to write October Surprise, which covered the Iran side of Iran-Contra. And then, of course, for many years, she's been a very dedicated 9/11 activist with a specialty in the Pentagon. So how about let's play that first cut from Behind the Smoke Curtain.
The title of my talk is Behind the Smoke Curtain. The alternative title for my talk is Or Everything You Think You Probably Know About the Pentagon Attack Is Wrong. So, what happened at the Pentagon and didn't, and why it matters so terribly much for our future. 1 year before 9/11, on September 11th, the year 2000, the neocon organization that called themselves Project for a New American Century, or you may have heard the acronym PNAC or PNAC, actually called in one of their publications for a new Pearl Harbor. This famous quote is from the Project for New American Century Manifesto from page 51. Quote, "The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, unquote. As the Project for New American Century Manifesto was being published, this offer was made to producer Aaron Russo a full year before 9/11. In September of 2000, Nicholas Rockefeller, of the Rockefeller family who built the Twin Towers, told Russo, quote, there's going to be an event, and out of that event, we're going to invade Afghanistan. So we can run pipelines through the Caspian Sea, so we can go into Iraq, so we can take the oil, so we can establish bases in the Middle East to make the Middle East part of the New World Order. And then he says, in my relationships with some of these people, the Rockefellers, the Council on Foreign Relations, etc., in my relationships with some of these people, I can tell you that is as evil as it gets. That's Aaron Russo. If he joined them, Russo was told, he would, quote, be spared the police state measures, the domestic surveillance state measures, that would be imposed on the rest of the American public, that means you, after, quote, the event, unquote, happened. This is a year before 9/11. And you can see this statement by Aaron Russo on a video on the net. The Project for New American Century neocons prepared the ground for 9/11 so it would be seen as a surprise attack, which it wasn't, and for the chorus of Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor, New Pearl Harbor on September 11th. In the months leading up to the 9/11 attacks, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld gave out literally hundreds, if not thousands, of copies of neocon Roberta Wohlstetter's 1962 book on Pearl Harbor, a book which pushed the false surprise attack and intelligence failures official line of the original Pearl Harbor attack. She was the wife of neocon godfather, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz's personal mentor, Richard Pearl's father-in-law, and Zionist passionate war hawk Albert Wohlstetter. The movie Pearl Harbor hit theaters in late May of 2001 using real Navy ships that were arranged with the Navy by the Navy's man in Hollywood, who was on deck to assure so-called historical accuracy and pyrotechnic special effect. Only an attack on an iconic national military facility, however, could give them their new Pearl Harbor. Just think about it. Even though on 9/11 the World Trade Center attacks were more spectacular, for sure, and they were the first attacks, the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2, they would have been likely seen, in my opinion, as just a very much bigger World Trade Center 93 or a much bigger Oklahoma City. But both of those attacks had already been handled by the civilian courts, and these people did not want the 9/11 attacks to be viewed as a bigger Oklahoma City or a bigger World Trade Center 93. They wanted them to be viewed as a new Pearl Harbor, which required an attack on something like the iconic military facility at Pearl Harbor, and that iconic military facility was the Pentagon. Only the Pentagon attack made 9/11 into the new Pearl Harbor that the authors of the PNAC manifesto wanted and needed to roll out their global domination agenda. They needed it to claim justification for endless preemptive wars, which we are still in over 11 years later, for their global domination agenda. And most people don't know, point three, for the creation shortly after 9/11 of the first U.S. mainland combatant command. It's called NORTHCOM. And what that means is, if you recall, that the Bush-Cheney administration very much wanted and said that the entire world, meaning including the mainland United States, your homeland, was now part of the global battlefield. And in order to make it literally a battlefield, they had to, for the first time, create a combatant command over mainland United States called NORTHCOM. It also enabled the new Pearl Harbor attack on the Pentagon, in addition, of course, to the other attacks of 9/11. But it was the key one, is what I'm arguing. Enabled the Bush-Cheney administration to bypass on 9/11, and before 9/11, there was joint authority over NORAD's response, over the jets that were so late in responding to all of the attacks on 9/11. Took an hour and 15 minutes, which was absurd. On and before 9/11, the decisions as to NORAD responses were actually the joint authority of the U.S. President and the Canadian Prime Minister. So once NORTHCOM was created, they separated out the decision-making, the unilateral decision-making authority of the U.S. President over those kinds of responses. Also, of course, the 9/11, and in particular, the Pentagon made it into the new Pearl Harbor, justified, they claimed, their domestic surveillance state that we are still within. And they enabled Bush Jr., President George W. Bush, to continually evoke Article 2 of the Constitution, his so-called commander-in-chief powers, which he did and members of his administration did over and over repeatedly to justify violation of our Bill of Rights, of U.S. federal law, of international law, and even Nuremberg principles. Bush even said that it was the Pentagon attack that made it war in his mind, and a new Pearl Harbor. In his memoir, which has been published, his book, and in his speeches after his memoir was published, he said that it was after World Trade Center 1 hit, he thought it was due to it just being a terrible pilot. That is an accident. He said in print that when he was told of the second hit, presumably we are told when Andrew Card whispered in his ear, America's under attack, even then he didn't think we were at war. Not per se. He said in his memoirs and his speeches after his memoirs were published that it was with the Pentagon attack that he knew we were at war. And you had to be able to sell to the American public and the world that we were at war in order to justify all these horrendous actions in the name of the 9/11 lie. Bush wrote in his diary on September 11th, quote, "The Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today," unquote. Because the Pentagon attack had, therefore, to succeed to affect us being at war, to affect the new Pearl Harbor, and to get their global domination agenda and surveillance state, they couldn't rely upon mere hijackers, no matter who they were, even if there were any. They had to control the operation. And in order to control it, they had to execute it, and only pre-placed explosives, both at the World Trade Center, as David Ray Griffin and Richard Gage and Niels Harrit and Professor Stephen Jones and many others have proven, is the real story at the World Trade Center, both World Trade Center's Towers 1 and 2, with planes, plane approaches and impacts, as the mere cover cause, so that it would be apparent that the buildings came down to the uninitiated because of the plane's impact and the fires. The same, as you will see from this presentation, is true at the Pentagon. That the real story at the Pentagon is pre-placed inside the building explosives with a plane approach and destruction as the cover cause. To get their new Pearl Harbor, the Project for New American Century neocon signatories, in order to be certain that they had it, they had to steal the 2000 election. And they did that in Florida, where Bush's brother was governor, Jeb Bush. A Project for New American Century signatory. Bush v. Gore was argued by none other than Ted Olson, whose wife Barbara's, we now know, non-existent alleged cell phone calls from the alleged Pentagon plane Flight 77 were the source, the most important source for the claim that the alleged Pentagon plane hijacker story, that there were hijackers on that plane. And without that story, there is zero evidence that Flight 77 even returned east. Even if it was Flight 77, as you'll see, that left Dulles Airport to begin with. And the entire official story of the Pentagon attack falls apart. And in case you question that the cell phone calls of Barbara Olson from Flight 77 have been deemed non-existent, that is now the official position of the FBI in the Massawi trial of the Pentagon and of American Airlines. It's per David Ray Griffin. Bush planned on being a, quote, war president, unquote, before he even ran for the office of president. He said so. With Bush's election, the Project for New American Century signatories then became the U.S. government. You will see that in the next slide, which I will not be able to read because it goes on in fine print forever, of all the PNAC signatories and participants. There were two levels, signatories and participants, who actually became the United States government. Once in power, however, only the Pentagon attack guaranteed Bush and the Project for New American Century signatory and participants, Bush becoming a war president, and they're getting their new Pearl Harbor to roll out their global domination and domestic surveillance state agenda. This will be in my book, all of this. But following the theft of the 2000 election, and by the way, Bush v. Gore was decided by the Supreme Court completely unconstitutionally, because the Constitution makes explicitly clear that in the case of a contested presidential election, that the House of Representatives makes the decision, not the Supreme Court. So following the theft of the 2000 election, the Project for New American Century Manifesto signatories and participants literally became the U.S. government uniquely, with the motive, means, opportunity, and access to effect their new Pearl Harbor in the attacks of 9/11. And what you could barely see here are, this is name after name after name of the individuals who were PNAC manifesto signatories and participants, and their absolutely top positions in the federal government once the election was stolen. Only the Pentagon attack enabled We Are at War, which you notice this is from immediately after 9/11. This is the National Security Agency, NSA, General Zahner, who was the head of their Signals Intelligence Directorate. And they apparently expected something to happen because they whipped out this We Are at War immediately after the attacks. Zahner was in charge of the NSA unit that surveilled calls to and from, and I put Al-Qaeda in quotes, Al-Qaeda's global communications center in Yemen for a minimum of a year and a half before 9/11. They knew exactly what was coming down. The new Pearl Harbor and war memes were pushed by the mainstream media as the attacks were literally in progress, before either of the towers fell in New York and they were smoking. This is just one example, but there are dozens. As the attacks were unfolding, the BBC in London began playing clips from Pearl Harbor. Tom Brokaw, NBC Today show, as the attacks were unfolding in New York, said, "There's been a declaration of war by terrorists. This is the most serious attack on the U.S. since Pearl Harbor." Time magazine, in its special September 2001 9/11 issue, said, quote, "What's needed in response to 9/11 is a unified, unifying Pearl Harbor sort of purple American fury, a ruthless indignation that doesn't leak away in just a week or two," unquote. Pearl Harbor was mentioned, war was mentioned by the mainstream media. 9/11 was clearly designed using the original Pearl Harbor attacks as its template. So what did the new Pearl Harbor insider script require the appearance of in the actual execution of the attacks of 9/11? They had to appear to be surprise attacks. They had to appear to be kamikaze pilot attacks, with planes this time used as weapons on buildings instead of ships. Both the original Pearl Harbor and 9/11 attacks were in the morning. There needed to be a critical mass of innocent deaths. The next slide after this one is truly chilling. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, and Bush both said immediately after the attacks they just couldn't imagine planes having ever been used as weapons in a kamikaze-like attack. Well, she isn't a historian, and a kamikaze attack triggered U.S. participation in World War II. It is, I simply can't imagine that Condoleezza Rice couldn't imagine. And Condoleezza Rice and Philip Zelikow, who became the executive director of the 911 Commission cover-up inquiry, and I put inquiry in quotes, were members of Bush Sr.'s A-team when he was president. They had co-published a book. They served on, as I mentioned, Bush Sr.'s National Security Council together, and Zelikow became her top aide plenipotentiary at the State Department when she moved to the State Department. And Zelikow, not surprisingly, in his own bio, states that he is an expert on creating public myths, you can read that as lies, and maintaining public presumptions about those lies, and call that cover-ups. He, Zelikow, was effectively the sole author of the 9/11 Commission report. He wrote its detailed outline before this so-called investigation even began. And Zelikow authored the Bush Doctrine for Unilateral Preemptive War under Condoleezza Rice at the State Department. I also interviewed Richard Clark, who was the so-called counterterrorism czar in the Bush Jr. Cheney White House. I interviewed him when I was at the Naval Postgraduate School, and he told me in an article that was actually, I published it on a DOD website online, that, quote, the White House approved all major exercise scenarios in advance. Now, the White House can only mean the National Security Council. And or Vice President Cheney. And the National Security Council was headed by Condoleezza Rice, and the counterterrorism czar was Mr. Clark himself. So what does that mean? I was the original researcher who uncovered the reality of and the importance of as the modus operandi for the planning, execution, and cover-up of the real inside perpetrator attack of 9/11, that at the center of that were military exercises that were taking place on the morning of 9/11 itself that were on hijack scenarios. So what we're saying here is that Richard Clark himself, the White House counterterrorism czar before and on 9/11, told me personally, and I have published it on a DOD website, that he and Condoleezza Rice knew of and pre-approved the hijack scenario exercises taking place before and on 9/11. To succeed, the real inside job 9/11 PSYOP required a critical mass of innocent deaths. Believe it or not, after the World Trade Center attack in 1993 that killed, I believe, 5 people and injured about 1,000, federal agents were heard to say by reporter Stephen Emerson that, quote, there had not been enough deaths this time. After the 1993 World Trade Center attacks, also, most people don't know this, but the World Trade Center tower's roof doors were locked, ordered locked, by official New York City policy. So that on 9/11, it happened, because of that, that the innocent victims above the impact zones were trapped, terrorized, and killed. They had no way to escape, except to jump. And even the New York Times published that I believe 105 victims had gotten right up to the door, where in 1993 they were able to go onto the roof, but they were blocked. Also, after the impacts and before the towers fell, dozens of military and civilian helicopters self-dispatched, wonderful people from the military, started flying towards New York City, intending to rescue survivors from the towers, to risk their lives and their helicopters. They were ordered to go to a nearby military base so that they could not respond. On 9/11, 2 World Trade Center tower attacks, 15 minutes apart, of course, ensured the maximum PSYOP, ensured this maximum live audience for the second World Trade Center hit and the towers collapse. After the 9/11 attacks, Paul Wolfowitz, who was a top signatory and participant in the Project for New American Century manifesto, published exactly a year before 9/11, and was Deputy Secretary of Defense on 9/11, immediately under Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, he actually had this to say about the critical mass of deaths in the 9/11 attacks. This is after 9/11 now. He predicted, before the final numbers were in, that the 9/11 attacks would soon be found to have resulted in a, quote, greater number of American deaths than any single day in U.S. history since the Civil War, more than any single day in World War I and World War II, and that Americans would now be willing to sacrifice their lives in great numbers for the cause of defeating terrorism, the so-called global war on terrorism. And quoted Winston Churchill, quote, America is like a great boiler. Once it gets fired up, the energy it generates is enormous. This was then echoed by Newsweek magazine immediately after, quote, more people were killed by the alleged suicide hijackers last week than the number of American soldiers killed in the entire American Revolution or at Antietam, the bloodiest one-day battle of the Civil War, or at Pearl Harbor, or on D-Day. And locking the roof doors ensured that. But none of any of this would have succeeded without the Pentagon attack. So, proving its official story a lie, as Richard Gage and David Ray Griffin and so many others have proven for the World Trade Center attacks, to prove that the Pentagon attack official story is a lie is so extremely important.
That's the voice of Barbara Honecker. Very heavy material. We have just played you the first 20 minutes of a three-hour DVD. This is a presentation that Barb gave up in Seattle a couple of years ago, 3 hours long. She gives an incredible PowerPoint presentation, lots of graphics, lots of pictures, and you can follow along with everything she says because the DVD is so well produced. It's called Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't and Why It Matters. Barbara Honecker, 3 hours long. This is our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter for a tax-deductible donation to KPFA of $100. $100, and we would be delighted to provide you with this information research-packed three-hour DVD Behind the Smoke Curtain. If you'd like to donate to KPFA today on Guns and Butter, please give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can always pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. I'm here live in the studio, delighted to be joined by my co-producer on Guns and Butter, Tony Rango. Hi there, Tony.
Thanks, Bonnie. Nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you on board. You know, it's so wonderful to get some help. I'm oftentimes in here all alone, and it's certainly it's better for the audience too if there's two people in here. 1-800-439-5732. $100 Behind the Smoke Curtain is yours. A blockbuster 3-hour DVD. Barbara Honecker covers it all, everything with regard to 9/11, and specifically the Pentagon. Tony, you know, I thought we might say a little bit something about the Guns and Butter website before we go back.
We can jump into that. Before we get to that, I thought I would let folks know I was just on the Amazon site about this movie, and it's full of 5-star ratings, including Bonnie's got one on there, a good quote from herself. But some really amazing stuff out there that people are saying about this movie. Blew my mind with her new film was this piece of one quote that I'm reading here. So it's really important that folks check this out.
Yeah, you know, Tony, I had forgotten that I had written a review of it, and when Tony said to me, look at the reviews on Amazon, and I went in there and I looked at mine and I thought, oh, I like mine the best. So what I wrote about it is the most comprehensive, penetrating, and courageous presentation on the September 11th Pentagon attacks that I have seen. The presentation covers it all, beginning with the planning for a new American century by the neocons and Zionists, including a new Pearl Harbor to launch perpetual war and the setting up of a domestic police state, the seizure of power through the stolen 2000 presidential election, detailed and verified proof that the official Pentagon story is a lie, media complicity with the perpetrators beginning before, during, and after the event, what really happened, evidence for pre-placed explosives, evidence of the real perpetrators, the philosophical underpinnings of the masterminds. This is a riveting 3 hours, including graphics, photographs, and point-by-point slides. A must-see blockbuster, highly recommended. That's my review of this incredible gift. You can get this wonderful DVD and at the same time support KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732, securely online at kpfa.org. G. Tony?
Yeah, we'd like to thank the pledge coming in from San Jose that recently came in. We'd like to thank you very much for that. And we should maybe talk a little about the website that we've launched. And
Tony. Tony's been busy on the website. You know, everybody for years has been saying to me, Bonnie, why don't you get your website back up? Well, people think that that's a snap. It's not so easy. So what's going on with that, Tony?
So there's a website at gunsandbutter.org. And from there, you can find archives. And we're putting up the new SoundCloud site that's got, I think, about 165 of your shows already posted with well over 7,000 listens and downloads. So people are finding it, whether they're your listeners or just people on SoundCloud. And then also an active Twitter feed that is posting things from the blog. So please go gunsandbutter.org to check it out and call in on this this video.
Thanks, Tony. And I've been checking out the blog. You have to, it's a drop down menu. Go to the blog. Tony's come up with some great articles. So that's a real resource, gunsandbutter.org. But right now, back to the business at hand. This is a fund drive for KPFA here on Guns and Butter. We're offering Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't, and Why It Matters with Barbara Honecker. 3 hours long. Riveting. It's heavy stuff, but boy, she has done the research. She's got the evidence. You can hear it. You can see it. $100 pledge to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $100 for this incredible 3-hour DVD. And then, of course, you are helping KPFA at the same time. A $25 donation makes you a voting member of KPFA and the Pacifica Foundation. So please, if you already have Behind the Smoke Curtain or you can't afford it, $25 goes a long way. You know, our old election supervisor, Les Radke, bless him, used to say that if everybody listening to KPFA out there donated $25, we wouldn't even need to have fund drives. So those $25 pledges are very important. If you want to be a member, you need to donate now. Don't wait. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter, and I'm joined by co-producer Tony Rango. Thank you for coming in, Tony. What do you think? Shall we start that second clip of Behind the Smoke Curtain with Barbara Honecker on the Pentagon attacks on 9/11?
Now, the official story also claims that Flight 77, a large Boeing 757, coming in very low at approximately 540 to 560 miles per hour, hit five light poles in a row, there they are, without exploding. But a 757 could not have hit one light pole, according to an expert I'm about to quote for you, let alone five in a row, and even made it to the wall without exploding. Why? Because the official story means that a 757, Flight 77 or otherwise, would had to have had still 11,250 gallons of flammable jet fuel in its wing tanks. Most people don't know, I certainly didn't until I did this research, that the largest, or two of the large, almost as large as the center fuselage tank, this is a graphic from Boeing's own website of its 757-200 series, which is what Flight 77 was. And this is flammable material, the jet fuel that is located in the two wing tanks, including tanks off to the way tips. And experts have told me, including Ralph Kolstad, who flew this very plane, he was very clear that the fuel in the center or fuselage body tank is used up first. And the official story says that Flight 77 or A 757 went out and turned around and came back. And before it hit the Pentagon, it was only out for an hour and 17 minutes. And it would have used the fuel from the center fuselage tank, and the tanks in the wings would have been flying fuel bombs. And the official story says that the leading edge of those two wings that are filled with still with fuel, according to the official story, hit five 240-pound light poles like this in a row. When the impact, I found this wonderful image of a single flying bird does this to a wing, And here's an example of what a single flying goose does to the lightweight carbon fiber nose of a plane. And as I mentioned, I interviewed Ralph Kolsett, the Top Gun Navy pilot who flew the physical plane. It was Flight 77 on 9/11. He said, if a 757 hit a light pole going at that high speed, it would rip open the wing, rip open the fuel tank in the wing. That wing would erupt into flames. The wings and probably the entire plane with it would have been destroyed before it could ever get to the building. When a leading edge of a wing of this jet hit just a single light pole, it sheared the wing entirely off, spilled jet fuel and wreckage over 100 feet, and crashed the plane to the ground. When the same thing happened to a large airliner, now that plane was smaller than a 757, but when the same kind of thing happened to a large airliner like Flight 77, which was in Detroit in 1987, 18 feet sheared off the left wing, which is the one that hit the light pole, when it hit two light poles, going at only 222 miles per hour, which was less than half the reported 540 to 560 miles per hour that Flight 77 was allegedly going when it allegedly hit five light poles in a row. And no wings or large wing pieces like this were found anywhere at or in the Pentagon. And even if Flight 77 or any large airliner had gotten through the light pole and tall 6-foot-high spools obstacle course, a plane couldn't have penetrated, I do not believe, the evidence shows, the newly hardened outer wall of the Pentagon. Wedge One's outer wall, which you see a graphic to the right from the Pentagon Building Performance Report, how the wall had been hardened after the Oklahoma City bombings. The Pentagon decided that they wanted to harden all of its outer walls to prevent that kind of an attack on the Pentagon. And Wedge One's outer wall, which includes where the official story says Flight 77 allegedly hit, had just been newly hardened to withstand terrorist attacks, specifically the kind that the official story says happened on 9/11. Now, this very much parallels, doesn't it, the World Trade Centers? Because we know that the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2 were specifically designed to withstand the impact of a plane like the official story says hit those buildings on 9/11. Same thing with the Pentagon in just that wedge. Interesting, isn't it? 2 feet thick after the upgrade, steel and Kevlar mesh. So the entire wall was like a huge bomb and plane-proof vest. This is what happened to the nose of a large airliner when it hit a non-reinforced wall. Unlike the hardened wall of the Pentagon on 9/11, far thinner than the Pentagon's wall, going at a mere fraction of the speed, I believe it was 88 miles per hour, claimed for Flight 77. To summarize this part, the official story at the Pentagon on 9/11 claims that after striking five light poles in a row, the leading edge of the wings, and somehow making it through the newly hardened wall that was specifically re-engineered to withstand just such a terrorist attack as at the World Trade Center, without its full wing fuel tanks exploding, which Ralph Cole said would have happened, a 757, according to the official story, then finally did explode, but only after it was almost entirely inside the building. And that, this is the official story now, that once inside the building, after being progressively shredded and dispersed over 285 feet, going at a diagonal 45-degree angle, that it turned into a quasi-liquid unexploded fuel and debris slurry, and that slurry somehow magically reconstituted itself after going around all of these still standing columns into a perfectly focused cone of energy, which somehow magically cut this almost perfectly round alleged exit hole in the ceiling wall, despite there being, according to Duane Dietz, former NASA director of research engineering, did an analysis of this slide from the Pentagon Building Performance Report. He has shown that there isn't a single path between the official story alleged entrance point or impact point of Flight 77 and the alleged exit hole in the C-ring that does not have multiple still standing columns in the way that would have dispersed this alleged quasi-liquid slurry. The FBI's official 911 investigation codename is Pent Bomb. It's not Pent Plane. And this stands for, officially, Pentagon Twin Towers Bombing. The FBI actually lied outright to one of the Jersey girls who had lost their husbands in the World Trade Center towers on 9/11, telling them that, quote, all of its investigation abbreviations end in bomb. This is a lie. The anthrax investigation, for instance, which is, of course, related to 9/11, does not. It is codenamed by the FBI Amerithrax, not Amerobomb. And as well, code names for investigations known to be about bombings do end in bomb. For example, the Oklahoma City bombing investigation is codenamed Oak Bomb. So it should tell us something that the FBI's code name for the entire 9/11 investigation is Pent Bomb. That it was the code name of the entire 9/11 investigation was reconfirmed by the FBI's own director, Robert Mueller, in 2011. The terrorist hunter, this is the cover image on that issue, which is right after the alleged killing of Osama bin Laden. FBI Director Mueller to Time Magazine, May 10th, 2011. Quote, the FBI's Strategic Intelligence Operations Center filled to capacity on September 11th and remained that way through Pent Bomb. The FBI's, this is still part of the director's quote, the FBI's cryptonym for Pentagon, Twin Towers, and bombing. The official story states there were no bombs at the Pentagon, that there were no bombs at the World Trade Center, that there were no pre-placed explosives, nanothermite or otherwise, at the World Trade Center or at the Pentagon. The FBI knows otherwise. The real story at the Pentagon, just as at the World Trade Center, is pre-placed explosives. Additional evidence for inside the building primary explosions at the Pentagon, similar to what you already know about pre-placed inside explosives at the World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7. Evidence that the Wedge 1 collapse, Wedge 1 again, the official story place of the alleged impact of Flight 77, evidence of the Wedge 1 collapse over the alleged plane penetration damage path on the inside of the building was in fact due to explosives. I'm about to give you that evidence, including possibly thermite. These are images on the top of the Oklahoma City Murrah Federal Building after it was known to have been destroyed by inside bombs as well as an outside truck bomb, but we know that there were at least four internal bombs in addition to the cover story outside rider truck bomb. And then at the bottom is the Pentagon after collapse of the section of Wedge 1 over the alleged impact point of Flight 77, using Al-Qaeda hijackers as the cover story. Witnesses to the sounds of a series of explosions also in the Pentagon use almost identical language to World Trade Center firefighters describing the going off of pre-placed controlled demolition explosives. So here are just some of these witnesses. Lieutenant McCowan, first floor D-ring in the Naval Command Center of the Pentagon on 9/11, quote, it sounded like a series of explosions going off, a series of bombs exploding, similar to like firecrackers when you light them and you just get that series going off. Again, identical language to the description of firefighters from the Nade Brothers video of the World Trade Center saying they went off like firecrackers coming down. Lieutenant Colonel Thurman, second floor D-ring of the Pentagon on 9/11, to me it didn't seem like a plane. To me it seemed like it was a bomb. Being in the military, I've been around grenade and artillery explosions. In other words, he's been around bombs. It was a two-part explosion to me. It seemed like there was a percussion blast that blew me kind of backwards in my cubicle to the side, and then it seemed as if a massive explosion went off at the same time. This is a photograph from Pentagon Building Performance Report of what's inside the columns of the West Wedge. These are reinforced steel supports. In fact, a massive explosion happened at just the time of the collapse of the outer wall over the alleged plane impact point, which is yet further evidence that another internal explosion caused that collapse. This is a live video clip from the Pentagon that morning. Note the time on the clip of 10:10 a.m.
That's the voice of Barbara Honecker. You're listening to the beginning of the second 20-minute clip from our pledge item today on Guns and Butter, Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. 3 hours, 3-hour-long DVDs. It's an incredible presentation, PowerPoint, pictures, graphs. You can follow along with her for three solid hours. She covers it all. meticulous research. It's very riveting. And she concludes this DVD with the perpetrators. Behind the Smoke Curtain, our pledge item to you today for a tax-deductible donation to KPFA Radio. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Of course, I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I do want to thank a few people who have called in. We're getting a good response. There's Chris Dates up in Healdsburg. Hey, Chris, thanks a lot. He's a big supporter of KPFA. I'd also like to thank John Angus from Boulder Creek, California. Thank you, John. Also, a big thanks to Leah Monterosa in San Francisco. Also, thank you to Eric Nilsson in Sebastopol. You can join these supporters of Guns and Butter and KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. $100 for the DVD, $25 makes you a member. Hey, Tony, it looks like we just got a match.
Very nice.
Okay, we got a $900 match. There's some encouragement from Dave in Berkeley, Anonymous in Oakland, and Susan from Inverness. $900 match on Guns and Butter today. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. That makes your money go twice as far. What have you got there, Tony?
I've got a few thank yous as well. Judy Boston from Concord, Tony and Mary Jackson from Merced, David McFarland from Sonoma, David Van Giesen from Santa Rosa, and Rhonda Lewis from Fresno. Thank you, guys.
All right, Tony. 1-800-439-5732. $100 tax-deductible donation to KPFA. Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. A three-hour-long DVD. Or you can pledge securely online at KPFA.org. We've got a match of $900, so thank all of you for helping us bring it in for KPFA today on the Spring Fun Drive. Right now, you need to call 1-800-439-5732 to support this Spring Fun Drive here on KPFA. You can pledge online at kpfa.org or call 1-800-439-5732. We've gotten a very good response so far. We've got a $900 pledge, so we need some more calls to make that pledge. We've got 10 minutes to go. Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, and what didn't and why it matters with Barbara Honecker. I'm telling you, she covers, I don't know how to say it. I mean, she covers everything about the Pentagon. The light, you heard the stuff about the light poles. It was always claimed that, of course, a 757 hit the, if it was a 757, I'm getting my planes mixed up, hit the Pentagon because the light poles fell down. Well, Barbara shows that the fuel is in the wings and it wouldn't be able to smash through light poles. She goes on to explain the columns within the Pentagon are still standing in the path of what is officially claimed as the path of the plane entering the building. But the columns, a lot of the columns are still there. Then very interesting stuff about what goes on the inner rings, people talking about explosions, etc., etc., etc. She deconstructs some of the controversial eyewitness testimony. I'm telling you, it's 3 hours jam-packed. And at the very end, she takes questions from the audience. So there's some Q&A at the end, and that's quite lively. That's Barbara Honecker, Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, why it matters. Our thank you gift today for a pledge to KPFA of $100, 1-800-439-5732. We're in a match period of $900. What have you got there, Tony?
I've got a few more thank yous. Mel Rosenthal from Oakland, David Walker from San Francisco, Peter Gill from Berkeley, and Karen Stern from Berkeley.
Oh, how nice. And thank you, Karen. And these are some people I know. This is wonderful because sometimes at public events, you know, I get to meet the listeners. Karen's a great. That's really nice. Thank you so much for those pledges. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member and enables you to vote in KPFA local station board. Very important to be involved in the governance of Pacifica. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member. $100, we'd be delighted to send you Barb Honecker's Behind the Smoke Curtain, 3 hours long. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter, if you just tuned in. I'm joined by Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango. Thank you, Tony. Tony's getting this stuff up on the website. I can't do this.
No problem, Bonnie.
So thank you, Tony. 1-800-439-5732. $100. KPFA would be delighted to send you Barb Honecker's information-packed, research-packed presentation, Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. $100 for that. $25 makes you a member, but you've got to make that call. We've got, oh my goodness, we've only got 5-6 minutes left, 6 minutes to go. 1-800-439-5732. We're in a match period. Three people have put up a very generous match of $900. Dave in Berkeley, anonymous in Oakland, and Susan from Inverness. 1-800-439-5732. What have you got? You've got some more pledges there, Tony?
A couple more. David from San Jose, thank you. That looks like Ron Martell from El Cerrito and Jerry Foster from Santa Rosa.
All right. Thank you. You can join all of these great supporters of KPFA and Guns and Butter at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You know, on the back of Barbara's DVD, there is a list of comments by some very top-level 9/11 researchers showing their support for her research. Quote, this will transform the discussion of what happened on 9/11. That from Professor David Ray Griffin. Richard Gage, of course, who Guns and Butter listeners are very familiar with, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, says, this presentation blew me away. Okay. Then we've got Professor Niels Herrett, quote, I think you're the only Pentagon researcher who is both honest and presents a coherent model. There's a quote from Annie Michon, former MI5 British intelligence. I met her, very nice person. Well done on an excellent presentation. And on and on, Dr. Tim Eastman, a PhD plasma physicist. Actually, he worked with my friend, the late Todd Fletcher, on the Pentagon. Tim Eastman, a plasma physicist, says, quote, you've done a great job and an outstanding service to the 9/11 truth community and to our country, tirelessly separating the wheat from the chaff on the Pentagon question. We are all extremely grateful for this. Well, I'm grateful for it, too, because the Pentagon has been the most controversial subject with regard to the alternative 9/11 research. So kudos to Barbara Honecker for putting it all together. When she retired or resigned from her job, she's dedicated herself full time to 9/11 research. Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, why it matters. Barbara Honecker, 3 hours long. Our gift to you today for $100, 1-800-439-5732. $100 for the DVD. We want to get some of those $25 pledges in here, too, for those of you who are not members, who want to become members and vote in our governance election. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm joined by co-producer Tony Rango. Well, Tony, any final thoughts? Anything we haven't mentioned about the website?
No, I think we've covered most of it. Just a kind of a quick rundown again. Make sure you give us your email at the bottom of any page for the newsletter so that you can stay informed about Guns and Butter. Go to SoundCloud, check it out. You can follow, share, and like there. Follow us on Twitter and stay informed, and do check out the blog. And please do comment. We want to hear your feedback. It's a great way. And also, we've got a contact form on there if you have suggestions or anything like that. We'll be getting getting back to you shortly.
Well, exactly. And, of course, it's very important if you want to stay on our mailing list that you have to actually, what, Tony, sign up? Is that it?
Right. You have to put your email in, and then it'll send you an email. It's sort of, it's called a double opt-in confirm. You put your email, and then you confirm via your email.
Well, they don't make it easy, do they?
No.
I've got a couple more people to thank. Mel Douglas in Concord. Thanks, Mel. He called in and pledged today. Don Moore in San Francisco. Thank you, Don. You can join these two people and all the other people who have called 1-800-439-5732. $100 for this incredible DVD. I'm telling you, you're not going to regret it. This thing is packed. And when I say packed, I mean packed with information, analysis, research, charts. You can follow along step by step with Barbara. It's very clear, and there's a lot there, and there's Q&A at the end, and she even goes into the perpetrators at the very end of Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. Please send me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at G-U-N-S-A-N-D-B-U-T-T-E-R.org. Of course, we're on Twitter. That's what, Tony? G&B Radio?
That's correct. Or you can find it from the website as well.
Yes, yes. We've got our Twitter feed up there on the website, kind of the way Webster Tarpley does it. We saw that. It looked pretty good, so we're trying that out. And, of course, there's a lot more to come on the website. Tony's busy at work on that. I got to hand it to Tony. He's got the energy. Looks like we made our match, Tony.
Excellent. Thank you all.
Thank you. We made that $900 match. I want to thank you all so very, very much for all your great support for Guns and Butter and for KPFA.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week and next, why a U.S. war against ISIS can only make the situation worse, just like every other U.S. war in the Mideast has done. Phyllis Bennis explains why. I hope you'll stay tuned. Phyllis Bennis gave a fine talk in Seattle this past February 2016, and we shall hear it, if the gods permit, this week and next. Bennis is a highly regarded writer and progressive activist. In recent years, she has focused a good deal on issues of Palestinian rights and the Israeli occupation, and more generally, on U.S. Middle East policy, and more generally still, on the bedrock U.S. foreign policy of war, war, and more war, anywhere and everywhere. Today, she will be focusing not on Palestine, but on those other flashpoints in the region, Syria, ISIS, and ISIS's home, Iraq. Bennis's credentials are pretty impressive. She's co-chair of the United Nations International Coordination Network for Palestine. She is a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. And she is a leader of United for Peace and Justice. She's also the author of 9 books on U.S. foreign policy and or the Middle East. On February 2nd, she spoke on the topic of her most recent book. That book is titled Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a Primer. It was published in 2015. This is the first I had heard her speak. I was really struck by the clarity and incisiveness and force of her words. Plus, she's an excellent speaker. Her political views are left progressive. These days, when every single one of the presidential candidates is screaming for more war in the Middle East and bigger Pentagon budgets, these days, Bennis's voice sounds like the intelligent and sane and humane one. So, don't expect to hear her on Meet the Press anytime soon. But you can hear her now, speaking on the folly of thinking we can bomb our way to peace in the Middle East. Here is Phyllis Bennis.
Thank you all for coming tonight. You know, 2 weeks ago was the 25th anniversary of the first U.S. war against Iraq in 1991. It's hard to imagine that it was that far away. It's 25 years. But if we look back at that, we can really see there the origins of the set of policy catastrophes of our country that led directly to the creation of ISIS in 2004. There's a direct line. I want to ask a question, but I can't see a thing with these lines. How many of you have heard, I'm not asking if you believe it, but how many of you have heard that ISIS was created when President Obama pulled the troops out of Iraq? Heard it, not believed it. Come on, admit it. All right, most of you know you've all heard it anyway. You're just not willing to admit it. But okay, we don't have to go there. But the point is, we know exactly when and how ISIS was created. We know its origins. That part, unlike some others, is not a mystery. And it was not in 2011 when President Obama pulled out the troops for a brief time. It was in 2004 when President Bush was supervising 150,000 U.S. and NATO troops that were occupying Iraq. That's what gave rise to ISIS, not the withdrawal of troops, the presence of troops. And if we look back 25 years, we can also see a trajectory that has led to what we're now seeing, the crisis in Syria, the 8 or 9 separate wars all being fought to the last Syrian, the disaster of Libya as a result of U.S.-NATO regime change, these crises across the Middle East that has led to a new global war on terror. This is, today's an anniversary as well. You all know this. This is Groundhog Day. So what's the deal with Groundhog Day? It's not the little thing they pull out of his, you know. I mean, these guys are nocturnal. They don't want to come out in the middle of the day anyway. It's like, where's PETA saying this is animal abuse? But it's not really about that. It's about this notion of repeating things. You know, it was Einstein who had this great line about the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That hasn't changed. The U.S. is repeating its policy over and over again and thinking that because it's a different president doing the same thing with a slightly different tactic that somehow it's going to work better. When we found out, we have a new report saying that conditions in Afghanistan are worse than ever and the Taliban now has control of more territory than at any moment since it was overthrown in 2001. And the answer is, well, let's send more troops. Yeah, because we did so well the first time around. You know, it's this notion of Einstein was wrong. We can do the same thing over and over again, and we will get a different result. Oh, really? How's that working for you so far? You know, this is a serious problem that we're facing here. In Groundhog Day, this notion of repetitive action is very much at the root of what we have to challenge today. You know, one of the things that happened when President Obama took office, on the second day in the White House, he sent a memo. They're very big on memos in the White House. The memo went to the State Department, to the Pentagon, to the White House staff, to everybody, saying, we don't want to use the term global war on terror. That was Bush's war. We're not doing that. We want to call it something different. We're going to call it overseas contingency operations. How Orwellian is that? This notion that you can call it with such a benign name, overseas contingencies. It's like there was a flood and we're sending some operators to help rescue people. No, this is a war. Call it what it is. I always like the term global war on terror, partly because the initials, the acronym GWAT, always had that evil sound, right? This isn't exactly the same, certainly. It's not relying on hundreds of thousands of troops. From the vantage point of U.S. troops, that's a good thing. From the vantage point of how many Iraqis and Syrians and Afghans are dying, not so great. Yesterday's New York Times had a fascinating op-ed by a former Army captain, and the little jump quote in the middle of it, it's an article about special forces and how critical they have become, how central they have become to U.S. strategy in the region. And it describes top secret missions, mythical warriors, and a state of perpetual warfare. That's what U.S. policy looks like today. We hear from President Obama a very important point, which is absolutely true and crucially important. And I so wish he would make it good. He says over and over again, there is no military solution. And you want to shake him and say, well, then why is it that every action we see is a military action? Because then he adds something that isn't true. He says, you know, the military action isn't enough. We also are going to need some diplomacy and negotiations and economic things and some other things. That's wrong. The problem isn't that the military isn't enough. The problem is that the military actions make all those other crucial actions impossible. Because if you're an ordinary Sunni Iraqi, say, and you see the U.S. coming and bombing, maybe it's an ISIS camp not far from your village. And maybe they get some ISIS people. But in the meantime, they've also bombed a few others. And the response in Washington is, yay, we got the bad guys. And the response in Iraq is, yeah, there's the Americans again, bombing the Sunnis in the interests of the Shia and the Kurds. So we're exacerbating the sectarianism. We're furthering the divide among the Iraqi people that we helped put in place when we overthrew a regime, a repressive regime, no doubt, but left this new system in place that was based deliberately, consciously, on imposing a sectarian-based system of political parties that had never existed in Iraq before. That's the challenge that we face now. And this is now a global war again. Yes, the U.S. is leading, not a surprise. We spend more than the top 9 other countries, including China, including all of our so-called enemies, more than all of them together. We spend billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars on the military every year, something most other countries are smart enough not to do. So it's not surprising that our assumption is that if there's a problem, it's going to be the military that has the solution. It's the old hammer and the nail. If you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you're the Pentagon, everything looks like it needs a military solution. The problem is that seems to be the problem in the White House and in the State Department and in Congress as well. For any of us, if we have a problem, call the Marines. That's a serious problem. Because put aside international law, put aside the morality of killing innocent people, inevitably, and just look at the success. Can't find it. Because the military solutions are failing. They've failed in the past, they're failing now, and there is absolutely zero reason to think they're going to succeed in the future. So this notion of saying that, well, San Bernardino changed everything. Paris changed everything. Ankara changed everything. None of these incidents change everything, except for the victims and their families. For them, yes, it changes everything. But it doesn't change the world. It was the same for us on 9/11. We had never experienced, no one in this country was alive the last time the United States was attacked. Pearl Harbor was not in a U.S. state. Hawaii wasn't even a state at that time. Nobody was alive when we were attacked from outside. So it was not surprising that people were paralyzed with fear. But the reality was, as horrific a crime as 9/11 was, a crime against humanity, it did not pose an existential threat to the United States. It did not threaten our democracy. It did not threaten our country. What threatened our country and continues to threaten, what threatened our democracy and continues to threaten, is what happened on September 12th, not September 11th, when the president announced that the response to this horrific crime would be to take the world to war. We were given the choice. We either go to war or we let them get away with it. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And if you're not with us, we will treat you as if you too were a terrorist. And we have treated people around the world and in our own country as if they were terrorists from that day forward. The problem is, you can't bomb terrorism out of existence. You can't bomb terrorism at all. You can only bomb people. You can bomb cities. Sometimes you might get lucky. You might hit a terrorist. You might kill a terrorist. But that doesn't eliminate the terrorism. It just creates more. There is no military solution. The solution lies in changing the conditions that give rise to terrorism in the first place and that make people's lives so desperate that they're prepared to embrace a level of horrific, violent terrorism because it still seems better than what they have at home. That's what we can change. Not fast, it's not sexy, doesn't make good television, but it's the only thing that will work. The talks that began in the last couple of days in Vienna, the Syria talks, I don't know if it's going to work. It's hugely problematic because it's really 9 separate wars that are being fought, all to the last Syrian. But the people who are at the table first are not any Syrians. It's the supporters, the outside supporters. Now, maybe that's what has to happen first. Maybe there has to be an agreement on a ceasefire between the U.S. and the Saudis and Turkey on the one hand, and Russia and Iran on the other hand, before you even bring in the Syrian regime and the Syrian opposition. Is that fair? Of course not. Is it just? Of course not. But the goal here is not about winning the war. It's about stopping a horrific war. And those who are trying to win it are not going to be happy by simply stopping it where it is, stopping it in place. But that's probably what needs to happen first. And it's not at all clear that de Mistura and his team from the United Nations are going to be able to pull that off. What we do know is that the potential for broadening the diplomacy over war that was represented in the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal, the potential for broadening that to a much bigger level of normalization between those two countries is not a done deal. It's still a possibility, but it may be that there is just not the willingness, more likely in Washington than in Tehran. There's problems in Tehran too, but the problems are more likely to come from Congress than from the hardliners in the Iranian Majlis, in the Iranian parliament. We don't know if that's going to work. It is a possibility, but the U.S. has been responding militarily, bolstering its military support of the Saudis as they take on Iran in the region, bolstering U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. None of this is going to help in the effort to broaden the victory of diplomacy over war that was represented in that Iranian nuclear deal. The military strategy is still failing. And every time we hear presidential candidates saying, I would do it better, I would light up the sands, I would use nukes, I would take them out, this is a serious problem. This is what the world is hearing from our elections. Who can outdo the next one in the talk of killing more people around the world? In the name of keeping Americans safe, when the reality is it puts us at much greater risk. It doesn't keep us safe. It's what engenders more anger and more terrorism at the end of the day. If we look right now, we have been at war against terrorism for 15 years. And where do we stand now? Suddenly ISIS is controlling territory. The Taliban, according to new military reports 2 days ago, now control more territory than they have since 2001. The Pentagon spends $500 million to create and train a Syrian opposition force that would be loyal to the United States, that would go after ISIS and wouldn't go after Assad, and would do things our way and be democratic and secular and not touch any of the Islamist forces. And what happened? They couldn't find any. Well, not entirely true. They found 54. No, they found 54. They sent them in to fight, and within 2 days, half of them had either defected, been killed, or put down their weapons and fled. The other 26 went back to fight, and they were almost all killed. $500 million. It comes out to pretty much, I can't do the math, but it's like more than $1 million each to train these guys. I mean, talk about a bad use of money. And ISIS still controls territory. Yes, they have lost some territory in recent months, and the U.S. tells us that's a great victory. Ramadi has been free of ISIS. Well, you could argue that's a victory. Defeating ISIS pretty much anywhere should be seen as a victory. But what did it really mean on the ground? ISIS had done enormous damage, not only to people, but to the city of Ramadi. But it was the U.S. bombing that finished it off. Those who have survived the siege of Ramadi have nothing to go back to. Their town is in ruins. It goes back to the Vietnam era. We had to destroy the village in order to save it. But this was no village. This was a city of 300,000 people. And the survivors of those 300,000 have no city to go back to. It's been destroyed. And in the meantime, ISIS is now going back to its old form of soft target terrorism as they lose more territory. Yeah, we can use the military for that. That would probably work. We can reduce their control of territory. And what happens? They go back to another form of terror. That's not a solution because it's done nothing to change the conditions that result in an ordinary Sunni doctor going off to join ISIS because it seems like a lesser evil than the horrific sectarian government in Baghdad that we are keeping in power. So Obama is right when he says there is no military solution. The problem is there's no one holding him accountable to his own words. And that failure, it means that you have to do something different. You have to learn from what the genius taught us, that you can't keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. So what does that look like? In Afghanistan, the new report that just came out from the special investigative, the special inspector general. The Taliban controls more territory. That of the $113 billion the U.S. has spent on education, this is supposedly the great thing we've achieved, right? At least we got the kids in school. Well, turns out, not so much. Of the $113 billion, $17 billion is just over 3 years, is already lost to corruption. And the main claim, we've got the kids, especially the girls, into school. It turns out that right now, 42% of Afghan children of elementary school age have either never been to school or have already dropped out. We have failed, and we have been lied to about what the war has brought to the people of Afghanistan. So when we look at this question, what was the origin of ISIS? There's a reason that I start sometimes by asking, you know, how many people have heard this line that ISIS began when the troops were pulled out? Well, they became visible in Syria around that same time, but their origins were years before. They changed their name. They changed what they believed in. They're a very changeable batch of fighters. But their history began fighting against foreign occupation in 2004. So when we look at that, we have to look at the impact that that has had on people in the region, on people around the rest of the world, and recognize what it means. Why are they so powerful? How did this happen? It's because they don't fight alone. Because when the U.S. went into Iraq and invaded Iraq, the first thing it did was to dissolve the military and throw out all the generals and all the colonels, and quite a ways down, I think as low as the sergeants. And all those people suddenly had lost their job, lost their privileges, sent home with no way to support their family, nothing but their weapons that they took with them. And they've been seething ever since. They've been angry ever since. They've been looking for revenge ever since. And ISIS shows up, and that's where they find it. So that's who's providing the military strategy and the training and the weapons training of all of that. It's not the ISIS militants themselves. They didn't just figure out how to do all this stuff. It's they've got the top generals that fought under Saddam Hussein. And those generals, quite frankly, were pretty good generals. They knew how to fight. That's why ISIS is having success now. So what does all this mean? What do we do about all this? We can look at all the origins of the crisis, and there are many. The role of climate change is huge here. The drought that began in Syria in 2006 and went through about 2010 drove somewhere like 800,000 farmers off their land. Syria was once the breadbasket of the region. That's where the wheat grows. And suddenly there was no rain, so there was no wheat. Farmers couldn't make a living, so they flooded into the cities looking for jobs. But neoliberalism had come to Syria in those last years, so there were no jobs. There were a few, but the few jobs go to somebody who knows somebody in power. That was more likely to be an Alawite who knew some other Alawite family, because the Alawites were privileged. And so you're exacerbating again the sectarianism that hadn't really been that much of an issue in Syria. Before the crisis, Syria had had a huge middle class. It had the smallest wealth-poverty gap in the whole region. So now there's people that are desperate. That's what leads to an uprising. That's what created the initial, what seemed so optimistic, the Arab Spring coming to Damascus. And then the repression sets in by this dictatorial regime. And then the war begins. And suddenly it expands. And it's now, as I said, it's at least 8 or 9 separate wars. It's regional wars between Iran and Saudi Arabia being fought to the last Syrian. It's also a religious war between Sunni and Shia, also between Iran and Saudi Arabia, being fought to the last Syrian. It's a war between the U.S. and Russia over things like naval bases and sea lanes, being fought to the last Syrian. At the moment, it's also a war between Turkey and the Kurds, partly being fought to the last Syrian. So the question of how do we stop this war and what do we have to do to stop ISIS and stop the Syrian war become enormous challenges. What are we doing wrong? Well, if you look from August of 2014, when the U.S. began its war against ISIS, The people of Washington State alone have paid $154 million in taxes. Your money. Just for that brief period, just for the war against ISIS. That doesn't count the war in Afghanistan. That doesn't count the war in Iraq that was already underway. It doesn't count the military budget. It doesn't count the bases. It doesn't count the nuclear weapons. It doesn't count anything except for just the so-called war against ISIS. If you had kept that money at home, here's a couple things you could have done with it. You could have had 1,524 kids in Head Start every year for 10 years. You could have had 1,624 veterans getting health care every year for 10 years. You could have 4,219 students getting four-year scholarships to the university. What makes us safer? Jobs and health care and education at home, or wasting our money on wars around the world that make people hate us and turn against us and turn to terrorism?
And here we must pause. Please tune in again next week for the conclusion of Phyllis Bennis's talk, plus selections from the Q&A. For the original recording, our thanks to Mike McCormick, host of Mind Over Matters in Seattle. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our fashion correspondent, Monica Lewinsky. On behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising, illegitimi non carborundum, keep the aspidistra flying, an injury to one is an injury to all, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight shorts. true. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
If you listen to the alternative public affairs programs on this station regularly, you probably get just how controlled, complicit, corrupt, and compromised the corporate and some, quote, alternative media are. But the three speeches you'll hear on today's show will probably still shock you a little and take you a little deeper into just how controlled and fraudulent much of our information sources are. All of what you're about to hear has been lightly edited to fit within our time constraints. The first speaker is Udo Ulfkott, a former German journalist and former editor of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. In 2014, he came out with the book Bought Journalism: How Politicians, Intelligence, and High Finance Control Germans Mass Media. And here he is, Udo Ulfkott. And this is from an interview he did on Russia Today.
I've been a journalist for about 25 years, and I was educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. But seeing right now, within the last months, how the German and American media tries to bring war to the people in Europe, to bring war to Russia, this is a point of no return. And I'm going to stand up and say it is not right what I have done in the past to manipulate people, to make propaganda against Russia. And it is not right what my colleagues do and have done in the past, because they are bribed to betray the people, not only in Germany, all over Europe. The reason writing this book was that I am very fearful of a new war in Europe, and I don't like to have this situation again, because war is never coming from itself. There is always people behind it to push for war. And this is not only politicians, this is journalists too. And I just have written in the book how we have betrayed in the past our readers just to push for war, because I don't want this anymore. I'm fed up with this propaganda. We live in a banana republic and not in a democratic country where we have press freedom, where we have human rights. If you see the German media, especially my colleagues who day by day write against the Russians, who are in transatlantic organizations and who are supported by the United States to do so, well, people like me, I became honorary citizen of the state of Oklahoma in the United States just because I wrote pro-American. I was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the CIA. Why? Because I should be pro-American. I'm fed up with it. I don't want to do it anymore. So I've just written a book not to earn money. No, it will cause a lot of trouble for me, just to give the people in this country, in Germany, in Europe, and all over the world, just to give them a glimpse of a view what goes up behind the closed doors. There is many examples for that. If we go just back to history, if you go into the year 1988, if you go to your archives, you will find in March 1988 that there was in Iraq, the Kurdish people have been gassed with poisoned gas. That is known all over the world. But in July 1988, they sent me to a town called Zubaydat, that is on the Iraqi-Iranian border. It was war between the Iranians and the Iraqis, and I was sent there to photograph how the Iranians have been gassed with poisoned gas, with German poisoned gas. You call it Lost and Zarin, mustard gas, made by Germany. They have been gassed, and I was there to make photographs how these people have been killed by poisoned gas from Germany. When I came back to Germany, there was just one small photo in a newspaper, in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and there was one small article not writing how impressive, brutally, how unhuman, how terrible it was to kill, decades after the end of the Second World War, people with German poisoned gas. So this was a situation I feel misused for having been there and just to give a documentary what has been done, but not being allowed to cry out to the world what we have done behind closed doors. Up to today, it's not well known in the public that with German public gas, there have been hundreds or thousands of people gassed in this city of Zubeda. Now, you ask, what have I done for intelligence agencies? So please see, most of the journalists you see in foreign countries, they claim to be journalists, and they might be journalists, European or American journalists, but many of them, like me in the past, are so-called non-official cover. That's what the Americans call that. I have been a non-official cover. Non-official cover means what? It means you too work for an intelligence agency. You help them if they want you to help them, but they will never, never, when they find out that you are not only a journalist, but a spy too, they will never say, oh, this was one of our guys. They will not know you. That means non-official cover. So I have helped them in several situations, and I feel ashamed for that too now. Like I feel ashamed that I have worked for a very recommended newspaper like the Frankfurter Allgemeine because I was bribed by billionaires, I was bribed by the Americans not to report exactly the truth. But I just imagined in my car while I was driving to this interview, I just tried to work out in my brain what would have happened if I would have written a pro-Russian article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. Well, I don't know what would have happened, but we were all educated to write pro-European, pro-American, but please, not pro-Russian. So I'm very sorry for that, but this is not what I understand for democracy and for press freedom. I'm very sorry for that. Germany is still a kind of a colony of the United States. You see that in many points, like the majority of the Germans don't want to have nukes in our country, but we still have American nukes. So we are still a kind of a colony of the Americans. And being a colony, it is very easy to approach young journalists through what is very important here is transatlantic organizations. All journalists from really respected and recommended big German newspapers, magazines, radio stations, TV stations, they are all members or guests of those big transatlantic organizations. And in these transatlantic organizations, you are approached to be pro-American. And there is nobody coming to you and saying, well, we are the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you like to work for us? No, this is not the case how it happens. What they do, these transatlantic organizations, is they invite you for seeing the United States. They pay for that. They pay all your expenses and everything. So you are bribed. You get more and more corrupt because they make you good contacts. You won't know that those good contacts are, let's say, non-official covers or officially people working for Central Intelligence Agency or other American agencies. So you make friends. You think they are friends and you cooperate with them. But they ask you, well, could you do me this favor? Could you do me that favor? And so your brain more and more is brainwashed through these guys. And is this only the case with German journalists? No, I think it is especially the case with British journalists, because they have a much closer relationship. It is especially the case with Israelis, of course, with French journalists for a part, not that big as with German or with British journalists. It is the case for Australian journalists, for journalists from New Zealand, from Taiwan, from, well, there is many countries in the Arab world, like Jordan, for example, like Oman, the Sultanate of Oman. There is many countries where this happens, where you find people to claim they are respected journalists, but if you look behind them, you'll find they are puppets on a string of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sometimes the intelligence agencies, they come to your office and want you to write an article. I give you an example, not from strange other journalists, from me myself. I've just forgotten the year. I just remember that the German Foreign Intelligence, Bundesnachrichtendienst, it is just a sister organization of the Central Intelligence Agency. It was founded by the American Intelligence Agency. So one day, the BND, this German Foreign Intelligence Agency, came to my office at the Frankfurter Allgemeine in Frankfurt. And they wanted me to write an article about Libya and about Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. I had absolutely no secret informations regarding Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and Libya. But they gave me all these secret informations, and they just wanted me to sign the article with my name. I did that, but it was an article that was published in the Frankfurt Allgemeine that originally came from the Bundesnachrichtendienst, from the German Foreign Intelligence Agency. So do you really think that this is journalism, intelligence agencies writing articles? That article was how Libya and Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, how he secretly tried to build a poison gas factory, I think in Rabta was the name, yeah. It was a story that was printed worldwide 2 days later. But I had no information on that. It was the intelligence agency that wanted me to write this article. So, but this is not the way journalism should work, that intelligence agencies, that they decide what is printed and what not. If I say no, I give you a very good example if you say no. Well, we have a rescue unit in Germany with helicopters for traffic accidents. They call themselves the Yellow Angels. There was one guy who didn't want to cooperate. He was a pilot of the helicopter service of the Yellow Angels in Germany. This guy said no to the Foreign Intelligence Service, Bundesnachrichtendienst, when they approached him and wanted him as a non-official cover to work for the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, just to pretend to be somebody from the Yellow Angels. So what happened was that he lost his job. And the court in Germany, the judge decided that they were right because such a guy could not be trusted. He was kicked off his job because he didn't cooperate with the Foreign Intelligence Service. So I knew what would happen if I would not cooperate with intelligence services. I have had 6 times my house was house searched because I was accused by the public prosecutor, the German public prosecutor. I was accused of leaking secrets of states. 6 times house searched. Well, they hoped that I wouldn't do that ever again. But I think it's worse that the truth will come out one day. The truth won't die. And I don't mind what will happen. I've had 3 heart attacks. I have no children. So if they want to bring me to court or to prison, so it's worse for the truth.
Next, you're going to hear former CBS News correspondent Cheryl Adkinson. She resigned from CBS in March of 2014 after 21 years. She's received many awards. One was an Emmy Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism for her reporting on the business of Congress. And here she is giving a TED Talk called AstroTurf and Manipulation of Media Messages. And this was first published on YouTube in February of 2015.
So consider this fictitious example that's inspired by real life. Say you're watching the news and you see a story about a new study on the cholesterol-lowering drug called Cholextra. The study says Cholextra is so effective that doctors should consider prescribing it to adults and even children who don't yet have high cholesterol. Is it too good to be true? You're smart. You decide to do some of your own research. You do a Google search. You consult social media, Facebook and Twitter. You look at Wikipedia, WebMD, a nonprofit website. And you read the original study in a peer-reviewed published medical journal. It all confirms how effective Cholextra is. You do run across a few negative comments and a potential link to cancer, but you dismiss that because medical experts call the cancer link a myth and say that those who think there is a link there are quacks and cranks and nuts. Finally, you learn that your own doctor recently attended a medical seminar. The lecture that he attended confirmed how effective Cholextra is, so he sends you off with some free samples and a prescription. You've really done your homework. But what if all isn't as it seems? What if the reality you found was false? A carefully constructed narrative by unseen special interests designed to manipulate your opinion. A Truman Show-esque alternate reality all around you. Complacency in the news media combined with incredibly powerful propaganda and publicity forces mean we sometimes get little of the truth. Special interests have unlimited time and money to figure out new ways to spin us while cloaking their role. Surreptitious astroturf methods are now more important to these interests than traditional lobbying of Congress. There's an entire industry built around it in Washington. What is astroturf? It's a perversion of grassroots, as in fake grassroots. AstroTurf is when political, corporate, or other special interests disguise themselves and publish blogs, start Facebook and Twitter accounts, publish ads, letters to the editor, or simply post comments online to try to fool you into thinking an independent or grassroots movement is speaking. The whole point of AstroTurf is to try to give the impression there's widespread support for or against an agenda when there's not. AstroTurf seeks to manipulate you into changing your opinion by making you feel as if you're an outlier when you're not. One example is the Washington Redskins name. Without taking a position on the controversy, if you simply were looking at news media coverage over the course of the past year or looking at social media, you'd probably have to conclude that most Americans find that name offensive and think it ought to be changed. But what if I told you 71% of Americans say the name should not be changed? That's more than two-thirds. AstroTurfers seek to controversialize those who disagree with them. They attack news organizations that publish stories they don't like, whistleblowers who tell the truth, politicians who dare to ask the tough questions, and journalists who have the audacity to report on all of it. Sometimes AstroTurfers simply shove intentionally so much confusing and conflicting information into the mix that you're left to throw up your hands and disregard all of it, including the truth. Drown out a link between a medicine and a harmful side effect, say vaccines and autism, by throwing a bunch of conflicting paid-for studies, surveys, and experts into the mix, confusing the truth beyond recognition. And then there's Wikipedia, AstroTurf's dream come true. Billed as the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, the reality can't be more different. Anonymous Wikipedia editors control and co-opt pages on behalf of special interests. They forbid and reverse edits that go against their agenda. They skew and delete information in blatant violation of Wikipedia's own established policies with impunity, always superior to the poor schlubs who actually believe anyone can edit Wikipedia, only to discover they're barred from correcting even the simplest factual inaccuracies. Try adding a footnoted fact or correcting a fact error on one of these monitored Wikipedia pages and poof, sometimes within a matter of seconds, you'll find your edit is reversed. In 2012, famed author Philip Roth tried to correct a major fact error about the inspiration behind one of his book characters cited on a Wikipedia page. But no matter how hard he tried, Wikipedia's editors wouldn't allow it. They kept reverting the edits back to the false information. When Roth finally reached a person at Wikipedia, which was no easy task, and tried to find out what was going wrong, they told him he simply was not considered a credible source on himself. A few weeks later, there was a huge scandal when Wikipedia officials got caught offering a PR service that skewed and edited information on behalf of paid, publicity-seeking clients in utter opposition to Wikipedia's supposed policies. All of this may be why, when a medical study looked at medical conditions described on Wikipedia pages and compared it to actual peer-reviewed published research, Wikipedia contradicted medical research 90% of the time. You may never fully trust what you read on Wikipedia again, nor should you. Let's now go back to that fictitious Kalextra example and all the research you did. It turns out the Facebook and Twitter accounts you found that were so positive were actually written by paid professionals hired by the drug company to promote the drug. The Wikipedia page had been monitored by an agenda editor also paid by the drug company. The drug company also arranged to optimize Google search engine results, so it was no accident that you stumbled across that positive nonprofit that had all those positive comments. The nonprofit was, of course, secretly founded and funded by the drug company. The drug company also financed that positive study and used its power of editorial control to omit any mention of cancer as a possible side effect. Once more, each and every doctor who publicly touted Kalextra or called the cancer link a myth or ridiculed critics as paranoid cranks and quacks or served on the government advisory board that approved the drug, each of those doctors is actually a paid consultant for the drug company. As for your own doctor, the medical lecture he attended that had all those positive evaluations was, in fact, like many continuing medical education classes, sponsored by the drug company. And when the news reported on that positive study, it didn't mention any of that. I have tons of personal examples from real life. A couple of years ago, CBS News asked me to look into a story about a study coming out from the nonprofit National Sleep Foundation. Supposedly, this press release coming out said, The study concluded we are a nation with an epidemic of sleeplessness and we don't even know it. And we should all go ask our doctors about it. A couple of things struck me about that. First, I recognize the phrase, ask your doctor, as a catchphrase promoted by the pharmaceutical industry. They know that if they can get your foot through the door of the doctor's office to mention a malady, you're very likely to be prescribed the latest drug that's marketed. Second, I wondered how serious an epidemic of sleeplessness could really be if we don't even know that we have it. Right? It didn't take long for me to do a little research and discover that the National Sleep Foundation nonprofit and the study, which was actually a survey, not a study, were sponsored in part by a new drug that was about to be launched onto the market called Lunesta, a sleeping pill. I reported the study as CBS News asked, but of course I disclosed the sponsorship behind the nonprofit and the survey so that viewers could weigh the information accordingly. All the other news media reported the same survey directly off the press release as written without digging past the superficial. It later became an example written up in the Columbia Journalism Review, which quite accurately reported that only we at CBS News had bothered to do a little bit of research and disclose the conflict of interest behind this widely reported survey. So now you may be thinking, what can I do? I thought I'd done my research. What chance do I have separating fact from fiction, especially if seasoned journalists with years of experience can be so easily fooled? Well, I have a few strategies that I can tell you about to help you recognize signs of propaganda and astroturf. Once you start to know what to look for, you'll begin to recognize it everywhere. First, hallmarks of astroturf include use of inflammatory language such as crank, quack, nutty, lies, paranoid, pseudo, and conspiracy. Astroturfers often claim to debunk myths that aren't myths at all. Use of the charged language tests well. People hear something's a myth, maybe they find it on Snopes, and they instantly declare themselves too smart to fall for it. But what if the whole notion of the myth is itself a myth and you and Snopes fell for that? Beware when interests attack an issue by controversializing or attacking the people, personalities, and organizations surrounding it rather than addressing the facts. That could be astroturf. And most of all, astroturfers tend to reserve all of their public skepticism for those exposing wrongdoing rather than the wrongdoers. In other words, instead of questioning authority, they question those who question authority. You might start to see things a little more clearly. It's kind of like taking off your glasses and wiping them and putting them back on and realizing for the first time how foggy they'd been all along. I can't resolve these issues, but I hope that I've given you some information that will at least motivate you to take off your glasses and wipe them and become a wiser consumer of information in an increasingly artificial, paid-for reality. Thank you.
And now we'll hear from the third speaker, three-time Emmy Award-winning journalist Amber Lyon, who worked for CNN. And this is from a 2013 interview on RT America, where Amber reveals CNN lies and war propaganda. And here she is.
Well, I really worry here that the United States public is being led into another potential conflict with Iran, the similar way that we were led into the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, because you're starting to see the mainstream media really overhype the situation in Iran and omit important facts. And if you look at all the propaganda being fed to the American public right now in terms of Iran, we have movies here coming out, Argo. We've got the mainstream media oversaturation of coverage of the Iran situation. And based on everything that's happening here in the U.S. with the mortgage crisis, the economy, the fact that most Americans are having problems just getting by day to day, the fact that the mainstream media is overcovering Iran only says one thing to me, and that's that the American public is being propagated into another war. And this is something that goes back to the terms weapons of mass destruction. The American public was fed that phrase over and over and over leading into the Iraq war. And now we're starting to see it as far as nuclear weapons and Iran goes in the U.S. And I just fear that the public is continuing to be fed propaganda that unassuming Americans don't realize they're being fed to lead us into another potential conflict. I really can't speculate as to exactly why this is going on, but I can tell you that when I was working for CNN, we did have a documentary that we aired on the Bahrain situation, and that's where we have our naval base, which is right across from Iran, so we strategically want to keep that naval base, and it was very difficult to get stories on about Bahrain. I even came out a couple weeks ago talking about the censorship of that documentary on CNN International. And above all, I feel that the American public is not being fed the true story about what's going on in this region. And it's very dangerous because when the public is constantly fed messages that are potentially leading us into a war that may not be necessary, it's not fair to the American people and it's not fair to journalism because the truth isn't being told here. What's being told here is the way that these networks want to spin the truth, and that's leading us into another potential conflict with Iran. And I've been trying to tell my followers on my Facebook page and on Twitter to really open your eyes, because once you notice, you take the blindfold off, you start to see all of this anti-Iran propaganda floating through the American mainstream media. And it's symbolic of exactly what was going on before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I still haven't been given an exact reason as to why it didn't air. I went and visited with the president of CNN International, Tony Maddox, twice on behalf of my dumbfounded crew, and we were never given an answer. And so I started investigating the situations after several employees who'd been at the network for years approached me and said, you need to look into this. There's something going on. It's very strange. They're not airing your documentary. And after some investigation, we found out that CNN International is actually making money from the Bahrain regime. They are a customer of Bahrain. Bahrain is paying CNN International to create content that shows Bahrain in a favorable light. Also, not only to create that content, to then air that content on CNN International. In one of the shows, it was called I List Bahrain. It was back in 2010. It was sponsored by Bahrain. And Richard Quest was live from the country for a week talking about the Formula One race and how progressive Bahrain was and how the Crown Prince was a reformer. Well, we saw in February 2011 that under the Crown Prince's rule, the military troops shot and killed unarmed protesters in broad daylight. And this is very dangerous because what CNN is doing, and they're not only taking money from just Bahrain, they've also produced similar content for Georgia, Kazakhstan, and other nations as well, Lebanon. And what makes this dangerous is they're not disclosing to the viewers that these sponsored programs are actually being sponsored. Or if they are disclosing it, it's in very small gray lettering at the bottom of the article. And that's dangerous not only to our foreign policy, but once again, making the American public and the public in general that's watching this network think that there are rosy situations happening in these countries when that's not the case, as we've seen with Bahrain. And it's defrauding viewers and it's defrauding their own journalists. I was not told as a journalist working at the network that this was going on. It wasn't clearly disclosed to me that at the same time I was investigating the Bahrain regime, Bahrain was a paying customer at CNN. They never told us why they weren't playing it, even though I asked the head of CNN International twice about it. And even bosses above me told me they didn't have answers for me and I'd have to go searching for those answers. So that pretty much, as an investigative reporter, tells me that something's going on. So on behalf of my crew, I got to get to the bottom of things. We had fixers and drivers in Bahrain who are currently now have been laid off because they helped us film that documentary. Some who are continually still harassed. Doctors Without Borders employee who actually drove us into these villages to show us doctors who'd been beaten by security forces. He risked his safety. Several months after our documentary, his home was burnt down. And in part, activists say because he helped CNN with that documentary. These sources, these people on the ground, did not know that at the same time, CNN was taking money from this regime to make rosy content that would negate their content. And they risked their lives. And I feel like CNN owes them an apology as well as an apology to viewers and its own journalists for defrauding them with this information.
So there you have it. Three journalists telling us how the controlled, complicit, corrupt, and compromised corporate and sometimes quote, alternative media really work. Based on these revelations, is it any wonder that we don't hear about the mountains of censored evidence that proves the official account of 9/11 to be totally fraudulent? Perhaps we could learn from Bahrain and buy our way onto these corrupt media outlets. But one thing we can surely do to exercise our people power is to just turn them off. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people.
building bridges.
Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Why more New Action Caucus candidates for the United Federation of Teachers union position deserve your support.
We're joined in studio by Gia Lee, candidate for president. Gia is the fourth and fifth grade special education teacher and is chapter leader at the Earth School in District 1. She is a public school parent and an opt-out organizer with Change the Stakes and New York City Opt-Out, a member of the Stronger Together Caucus and a national network of social justice caucuses.
And Camille Letourneau, candidate for secretary, has been an English teacher since 1996. She was elected to chapter leader and won grievances that were said to be unwinnable and organized her chapter into a force at many union rallies. As a leader in the independent community of educators, she was instrumental in the battle against the giveback-laden 2005 contract. She is now a delegate from Humanities and the Arts High School in Queens.
And Jonathan Halabi is candidate for the high school division of the executive board. He is a U of T chapter leader and a math teacher at the High School of American Studies at Lehman College. He's been on the U of T executive board from 2009 to the present. Jonathan describes teaching as an honorable career. We help kids learn and grow. Their success is our reward, but not if we are mistreated, not if our voices are ignored, not if decisions that affect our schools are made out of incompetence and malice. We are running to ensure all our voices are heard in our union. Now, we want to welcome the three of you to present your views on, shall we say, union reformation and democratization, and most critically, what you as union members, as teachers, professionals do to enhance the education system of public school students. By way of saying that, More New Action says, if you're tired of the attacks against teachers and public education, if you're tired that our students' education has been hijacked by a test prep curriculum focusing our time on data instead of teaching, then we need something different. We're going to get back to that question of what something different is, but I wanted to give Jonathan and Camille and Gia opportunities to give us an opening statement.
This is Gia. Many of our students are faced with conditions, situations that are beyond their control. We as educators are fighting and facing these with them each and every day. And we need to have a mobilized rank and file membership to be able to support our school communities. For me, just a little bit of background, I am a fourth and fifth grade teacher. I'm a special education teacher. So I've actually taught from grades K to 12 since 2002. I've found that many of the conditions our students need to be able to thrive are at odds with policies that have been top down. We've been a part of an incredible amount of pushback, even at the school level, the less autonomy teachers have in the classroom to support their students. This is in keeping with the kinds of issues that people who teach in progressive schools are finding at odds. Just recently at CPE1, that Central Park East 1, the progressive school that is basically the foundation for the Earth School, which is where I teach, is under attack with a new administration who is trying to undo a lot of the progressive education policies. What we're trying to do now is find a way to bring to our union empowerment to be able to allow us to empower our students and ourselves. And I actually became chapter leader as a result of a Leadership Academy principal at my previous school, which was PS63. As a result, I found myself pushing back, having to form consultation committees on issues such as professional conciliation. The amount of micromanagement was intense. I couldn't understand what was happening and where our union was. As soon as I entered the Earth School, I discovered that there was a lot of progressive educators who were able to have autonomy and work with others in collaborative ways. And I said, I can't be silent anymore. It's what empowered me to fight back. Thank you.
And Jonathan?
It's very interesting. Gia is an elementary school teacher. I'm a high school teacher. People often say that elementary school teachers and high school teachers look at things differently. Elementary school teachers look at the kids, and high school teachers look at their subjects. That's not entirely true, but it informs a slightly different take on the problems that we're running into. I came into teaching 19 years ago to teach mathematics. And people would correct me and say, well, you're teaching kids. And it took me a while to really get that. And it is important. I wanted to teach math to kids. But I would say at the beginning, teaching math. I got very involved. I got involved in the State Math Federation. I was on their executive board. I helped found a new school and develop the curriculum. I worked on reforming problem curricula in the Bronx. As I worked, I learned a couple of things. I learned how to teach math from having other teachers around me who knew what they were doing, who are supported, who are in good environments. And because of that, I was able to be a good teacher for kids. The kids and the teaching go together. But those conditions where experienced teachers taught beginning teachers have been disrupted. It's so sad and so unfortunate. It's no longer a career that people go into with a good prospect of being able to stay. And we need to turn that around. Under Bloomberg and under Klein, the amount of abuse, administrative abuse of teachers, the excessive, insane paperwork, and more recently with Gates, the crazy curricula, have really made it impossible to develop a core of long-term stable teachers. And without them, how can our kids learn? But our union isn't fighting back on exactly those issues. I think that's exactly where we need to begin. If we want to give kids the education they deserve, we need to help and support the teachers who come into the system, the new teachers, become that teaching core that all of us deserve.
Camila Turno.
I spent my formative years in the island of Jamaica in the West Indies. There I was privy to real trade unionism. The teachers' union and other unions on the island were not adverse to striking and being combative with management whenever they thought that things were done not in the best interest of his workers. So I'm a little shocked when I see so many people afraid of mentioning the S word as if it were a dirty thing. I also have experience with spending summers in London and watching the UK teachers not being afraid to go on strike, getting on a plane and hopping over to France and seeing workers conduct a one-day general strike. No one was able to do anything on the land, sea, or air. And I was fascinated by that. So I'm a little shocked to see why so many people in America here are so adverse to the idea of fighting back. I also want to follow that up with talking about living wages and decent salaries. So many people here in the United States are struggling to make ends meet. I'm often wondering what is going on in the minds of management that think it's okay to not pay people decent salaries. I'm specifically going to speak about our most recent teacher's contract. I must say those raises are pathetic. We are now receiving 10% over 7 years and 1 month. 1 month was added because thousands of teachers retired and they didn't make any provisions for figuring out how much they were owed, so they had to go back and renegotiate an extra month. I don't understand why there is so much fear in fighting for our dignity when the system right now, New York City has a $6 billion surplus. We're not feeling the effects of these surpluses. My classes, 35, 34, 36, this is high school. Why aren't we using these monies to lower class sizes? 9 years ago, we talked about fiscal equity. What happened with that case? Nothing has changed the numbers in our high school class sizes. Thank you.
Wonderful. Let's go back to that question. The question of if you're tired of the attacks against teachers in public education, if you're tired that our students' education has been hijacked by a test prep curriculum focusing our time on data instead of teaching, then we need something different. So what's wrong with the incumbency, the leadership of the UFT, that you would have the union do something? And what would that begin to look like to really enhance and bring back the superior education that was part and parcel of the public school system in this country? I think Gia's going to start us off.
You know, it was in 2009 when Bill Gates said in front of the National Conference of State Legislatures that when the tests are aligned to the Common Core standards, the curriculum will line up as well. And that will unleash powerful market forces in the service of better teaching. For the first time, there will be a large base of customers eager to buy products that can help every kid learn and every teacher get better. And I think what we've found is that now teachers in the schools knew nothing about this agenda until it was happening to us in the school systems. When I discovered that our national AFT president had taken millions of dollars from the Gates Foundation to support the Common Core standards, I was shocked. And then when I found out that our own UFT leadership had also taken millions of dollars here in the city to support these standards and the teacher evaluation system that was aligned to it, I was also really dumbfounded. We need to regain empowerment from the bottom up, no longer negotiating at the top with politicians who are in the pockets of corporate entities. Rather, we need decision-making from the ground up, grassroots, to democratize our union. So much of our decision-making is being done top-down. We're a business union. I don't even know if the word union can even be used in this situation when our union has become an arm of the government. So I find that the only way to change, and I've done job actions myself, it's gotten some media attention. I've refused to administer the tests, the state tests, as an act of a conscientious objector. But we need a mass movement, a mass awareness that compliance is not going to get us anywhere. We need complete engagement to change the system.
What's happening is we are teaching to the tests. And I became an educator because I believe in lifelong learning. I welcome the opportunity to empower my students to realize that learning is for life. And so I am being pressured right now to teach to the New York State Common Core English Regents. I'm also being pressured to teach to the what's called the MOSL, the Measure of Student Learning. Both exams are putting us in a position where we are forcing our kids only to learn basically to write argumentative essays. By and of itself, it's not a bad thing that they have to become better writers, but the reality is that the emphasis is being placed on these exams, and it's not placed on cultivating lifelong learners. It's not placed on getting our kids to understand that these skills transfer over in their daily lives, and it's not allowing our kids to develop a love of learning.
We've talked, or rather you've talked about empowering the teachers vis-a-vis the administration of the schools and vis-a-vis the union hierarchy. But where does the community come into all of this? How does the community get their say? And I know that you're advocating a People's Board of Education. What is that?
You know, it wasn't too long ago that we had locally elected school boards. You know that probably around 2007, 2008, when mayoral control happened, our union stood by. Our union did nothing to fight it. They went along with it. We once had locally elected school boards. I believe that when we gave up our voices, our ability to make decisions alongside the parents and students and other community members about what our schools should look like with culturally relevant pedagogy and being able to attend to the needs of our students beyond just academics, we gave up everything. It's time that we take that back and undo mayoral control as part of it.
Under Bloomberg and Klein, there was
Jonathan
Holliday. There was a systematic effort to disenfranchise the community through some very obvious things and through some that were less obvious. As they broke up our high schools and as they turned to something called City as Zone, where a high school student could end up anywhere across the city, they broke up the local school as a community institution. I've taught in the Bronx my entire career, where I started. For some people, their community, the church and the school, were the stable institutions, and they've destroyed that. And in the Bronx, they destroyed it with the UFT's complicity. The UFT signed contracts at 20 – it was Gates money starting way back over 15 years ago to do that. Getting the community involved, I think, means getting back to the position where schools are serving individual communities. There can be special schools where kids move across boroughs, but that should be the exception. Most people should be joined in their community with their community's school.
Many people would say that a fight for racial and economic justice within the unions, as the unions then take it up within the community, is not what the function of unions are. The function of unions are to service their members, to file grievances, to work essentially around bread and butter issues. But you all seem to be saying that the union has to be more integral in working with the students, in hearing the voice and having a discourse with the teachers as to what the education process would look like. And Ken raised, which you all seem to be sympathetic to, the issue of the union being responsive to the community as part of the educational process. But that's not what unions do. What do you think?
I'm going to beg very, very loudly to differ. It is what unions do, and it's what unions need.
So take that, Rosenberg.
It's what unions need to do. To some extent, it's what we're already trying to do, limited. I think we could do a whole lot more of that. I'm part of the New Action Caucus. It's a different caucus with a different history.
And that both has come together.
And we've come together now for the last decade or so because of the attacks of Bloomberg and Klein. We work together with the current Unity leadership. We really thought that combating those guys was really very important. We stayed critical where possible. But in the process of doing that, we were able to raise some issues, and we continued to raise issues. And they were partially responsive. But I think the union can lead when we do things like supporting the DREAM Act, when we take the lead on stop and frisk. We were the first union in the city to come out against stop and frisk. When we marched,
but wasn't that under the UFT leadership with Mr. Mulgrew?
So they can do some of that, but we needed to push them. Every one of those initiatives they got pushed on, it shouldn't be pushing. That should be us together out front on this. And we really can be leaders in the community.
Hi, this is Gia. I just want to piggyback off of that. You know, New York City is the third most segregated in the nation. It's a hugely disproportionate number of schools who are targeted under the current evaluation system with the use of faulty metrics, albeit the standardized tests, where 81% of the schools are disproportionately located in black and brown communities here in New York City. It's also the same metric system that is contributing to the disappearance of black and Latino educators in our city, not just here, but nationwide. So I feel that this is the critical issue of our time, that we fight back against the privatization of our schools because it is part of systemic racism.
I wanted to ask about funding because I haven't heard too much come out of Mulgrew about funding by the state of the school system. And the schools took a big hit a few years back with the fiscal crisis, but they also were supposed to have contributed more money to the campaign for fiscal equity, especially for the poorer schools throughout the state. And as far as I know, I mean, there just seems to be a wall of silence. Nobody's talking about this. But that really didn't happen in this last budget, as far as I know. Am I wrong? Am I right? Grade me.
I think that's correct.
And that's
this is Camille. It's interesting that we're having this conversation 9 years later. There was a lawsuit, and it was legally binding, we thought, which would force the city to reduce class sizes. But 9 years later, we're still battling oversized classes. Yes, the state still gives us funding. However, I think a lot of that fund is going into the slush funds of our administrators. Because of that, they are now able to give us more professional development. Not that there's anything wrong with professional development, but at the same time, we have to take a step back and look to see what are we really doing to our kids when we cram 35, 36 into a tiny room and leave that class with one teacher. Are we really about educating our kids?
Well, the current head of the UFT, who has been there for some time now, is generally perceived of in the broader public as a strong union leader that is enmeshed in the best representation for his teaching body that is indeed taking huge hits from the public. I've never seen such a campaign as I have in the last really 10 years of degradation and disdain for teachers, which were long considered one of the most valuable and important of professions, as well they should be, because, as I remember, certainly the Cubans used to say, our most valuable resource is not tobacco and it's not the oil, it's our youth, it's our children, it's our future. So, Camille, let's just start with you. You obviously feel that the perception is wrong, that this is a leadership that has not stood for its teaching body and given them the kind of contracts they need and the kind of support they need, as well as the issues that you've been talking about, the community. Can you speak more to that point? So you're going to be on the executive board at another juncture. You're going to assume the seat. What wasn't done by the current UFT leadership?
Oh, gladly. One of the things that I
such vibrancy. That was the right question.
Our teachers are under attack. I almost feel like if we're not careful, we'll end up on the endangered list. We are, unfortunately, many of us working in hostile and toxic environments. And our UFT, the current leadership, fails to understand that we are under attack in many of our schools. And the reality is, if we're under attack in our schools, we are not going to be the best that we can be for our kids because we're too busy warding off attacks from all sides, from our administrators and from the central DOE. Consequently, it pits us against management. So this is an adversarial relationship. It's a hostile environment. It's the level of toxicity that seems to permeate many of our buildings. Where members are feeling afraid to even go against any single administrator because the attack is vicious and it's swift. And we are not better in our kids when that happened. I have yet to see any research that says the more we attack our teachers, the better he or she is going to perform and the higher the statistics of our kids who are performing. It has never happened. So why the UFT leadership isn't helping us to ward off these attacks is unconscionable.
This is Jonathan. There are two particular kinds of attacks that I find very, very concerning. There's a third, new teachers, and you heard I care very deeply about getting new teachers into our system. But when senior teachers, experienced teachers, get attacked, when their schools get downsized and they aren't placed in positions but made to go from school to school and then treated like dirt, and the union doesn't step in, that's horrible. It sends a message to everybody that doing a good job for a long time doesn't guarantee you anything. But even more important, the drive between the top of the union and the members, the connection, the key connections are our district reps and our chapter leaders. Chapter leaders are probably the only people that our members vote for who they actually know. And our chapter leaders are more and more getting fake charges against them, getting hassled, getting harassed, and the union no longer steps in to defend those chapter leaders. And that sends a message to everybody in the school. Nobody is safe. We need to turn that around. We need to protect and stand up for everybody. But the first one, an attack on a chapter leader, should be met by an immediate, strong response. This may not happen. And it's happening now. And when we're in, it will not happen.
This is Gia. I just want to also say that, you know, in the last contract, I'm in a school that's considered under PROS, Progressive Redesign, and it's a long acronym. I can't remember the whole thing. But I will say that there were about 200 schools that were slated within the contract to be able to apply for this, and essentially allows for these schools to be able to design their own measures of student learning. I find that to be divisive. And in any union, we should have a sense of solidarity. Within the same contract, you had provisions for the absent teacher reserve folks who were basically being told, hey, how about you take an early retirement and we'll give you, you know, something out of it, rather than supporting those teachers to find permanent placements as promised. We've created a tiered system within our own contract, and that should just not be. We should have a sense of solidarity within our schools. We should be able to have a sense of solidarity amongst schools within a district and beyond. And we just don't have that right now. It's a divide and conquer system, and our union has fallen into it.
Are there ways to bring up some of these issues at union meetings? And if you do, what happens?
This is Jonathan. I'm currently on the executive board, and we do raise some of these issues, sometimes as on the exec board, sometimes as questions to make them aware of it. For example, a few years ago, we caught wind. The leadership knew, too. They didn't say anything about it, that almost every second or every third probationer wasn't being given tenure but was having their probation extended. We got up and we asked a question. Other people at the executive board got up and mentioned it as well, but they weren't really supposed to, and they hush-hushed it. That's one thing. Sometimes we'll bring a resolution, and they'll if it doesn't involve actually fighting against the union against the DOE, sometimes it passes. But more often they will table it. They'll come back. They'll make it a little bit weaker. They'll take the teeth out of it, or they'll table it forever. These issues, you can raise them. They don't go very far. That's at the exec board.
This is Gia. I have, as a member of MORE, been a part of raising resolutions at the delegate assemblies. We've attempted to raise numerous resolutions on issues on the teacher evaluation system, parental leave, getting retro pay for those who are on medical or maternity leave, and they were all simply shot down by the Unity Caucus.
And that's why?
You know, that's a really good question. In terms of the teacher evaluation system, we raised an I Refuse resolution that was passed in many locals upstate and in Long Island, supported by the Stronger Together Caucus at the state level, and it was passed. Yet at our own local level, we could not seem to get any movement on it. Things that are often said are that, you know, some teachers were saved using the value-added measures. Instead of talking about, well, maybe there's something going on with the administration targeting teachers at the school and how we should address that, they're saying, oh, the observations were horrible, but the VAM, the value-added measure, saved them. And so they wanted to keep, you know, whatever the teacher evaluation system is. Yet it's conflicting at the delegate assemblies.
And the question is, lastly, when is the voting?
That will take place in the month of May. The ballots will come in people's mail at home. Please don't throw them out. We only had about a 17-18% return rate last election. We need to get that much higher. Everybody get involved. Yeah, it goes to you just mail it to the American Arbitration Association. It's very easy. Check off MORE New Action, put it in the envelope, and send it back in.
A vote for MORE New Action is a vote for your voice. It's a vote to empower your students and communities. Do it.
I want to thank Gia Lee and Camila Turnow and Jonathan and the MORE New Action combined caucuses who are running to assume the positions on the UFT and to take back the union to enhance our education, our public school education, to preserve it, to make it better, and to make our unions more responsive to its membership. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And don't
Thank
you, you all be a dropout, because you all got a vote. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. O-R-G.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
This is an issue that the left started, not the right.
If you do not leave right now, you're going to be placed under arrest.
Whose house is it?
I can't overturn state laws unless a federal law is passed that prohibits states from doing these things. And with the Congress I currently have, that's not likely to happen.
Leave it the way it is.
You don't have a right to impose your lifestyle on others.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The North Carolina conflict cranks up, marriage equality becomes reality in Columbia, and Salt Lake City comes out for Harvey Milk. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending April 30th, 2016. Lesbian and gay couples can finally tie the knot in Colombia. The South American nation's constitutional court issued its final order on April 28th after paperwork delayed the implementation of its April 7th 6-3 ruling opening civil marriage to same-gender couples. They were only able to enter into civil unions before being allowed to legally march down the aisle this week. In an earlier lawsuit, the High Court ordered the nation's lawmakers to enact marriage equality legislation by June 20, 2013. They failed to meet that deadline, which automatically allowed gay and lesbian couples to get married. But they were required to have a notary or judge formally solemnize their commitment. Many judges and notaries refused. Four same-gender couples who were turned away filed the lawsuit that led to this week's finalized ruling. The High Court stated definitively that no judge or notary could legally refuse to marry a same-gender couple. The same justices lifted a ban on same-gender couples adopting children last November. Alberto Rojas Rios, the judge who wrote the marriage equality ruling, told the El Tiempo newspaper that it was in force now. He said that a civil marriage could be performed by a municipal judge, notary public, or any other public servant authorized to perform them. Colombia joins Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in heavily Roman Catholic Latin America. Advances in a growing number of states are also hastening national marriage equality in Mexico.
A 6-3 majority in the Legislative Council of the Isle of Man approved a marriage equality bill on its third and final reading on April 26th. The Marriage and Civil Partnership Amendment Bill replaces the civil partnerships that have been available to lesbian and gay couples since 2011. They can now march down the aisle, on the aisle. The self-governing British Crown Dependency sits in the Irish Sea between England and Northern Ireland and is home to about 86,000 people and, by some accounts, a lot more sheep. Chief Minister Alan Bell came out last year and confirmed a not-so-secret relationship of more than 21 years. It's a totally logical human right and a human expectation, he said, that straight couples and gay couples should be able to enjoy life with a partner that they choose.
Lawmakers in the Faroe Islands voted 19-14 on April 29th to open civil marriage to their gay and lesbian couples. About 49,000 people call the self-governing series of volcanic islands in the Kingdom of Denmark home. They're located between Iceland and Norway in the North Atlantic Ocean. Denmark itself established marriage equality in 2012. Unlike their Danish brethren, however, the Faroe Islands law does not allow church weddings, which was the only way to get votes for the measure by members of various Christian parties.
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull explained during an interview this week on Tasmanian radio station 7HO FM why he backed a non-binding national plebiscite on marriage equality rather than passing a marriage equality bill in Parliament. He said he was simply upholding the will of the coalition government that he inherited from former PM Tony Abbott. But he predicted, as happened in Ireland, that the public vote in Australia would be overwhelmingly supportive.
I think it'll be a perfectly civil debate. I think I will be voting yes. I'll be voting for to legalise same-sex marriage.
Good on you.
And I think that the plebiscite will be carried. I think there will be a positive vote.
So I could potentially start shopping for all the weddings that I may have coming up in the next, let's hope, 6 months. You know?
Well, you That's up to you. But I think you're unlikely to be disappointed. But it will be. But it's ultimately, the three of us will have one vote each.
Yeah.
And so the Australian people will decide.
The plebiscite is supposed to be held after the next federal election, but it's not at all clear when that will happen. Some observers say elections might not be called until as late as January 2017. But if the pro-LGBT opposition Labour Party outpolls Turnbull's Liberal National Coalition government in those elections, a simple parliamentary vote on equal marriage, with the help of the long-supportive Green Party, would almost certainly pass, thereby cancelling the planned plebiscite altogether.
Elsewhere, an Egyptian court has sentenced 11 men to from 3 to 12 years in prison just for being gay. The 11 men were each convicted of debauchery and incitement to debauchery. Private consensual adult gay sex is not explicitly illegal under Egyptian law, but gay men are prosecuted under debauchery statutes, so authorities have a tool to harass and persecute them even without specific anti-gay laws. Three of the men were jailed for 12 years, three for 9 years, one for 6 years, and four for 3 years. Dalia Abdel Hamid, director of the Gender Studies Program of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, told reporters that raids against the LGBTI community have become so common in Egypt that we have almost become accustomed to wait for them to arrive. A long-running crackdown on sexual minorities, especially in Cairo, has gotten worse. Police are using dating apps to lure gay men to their arrests and to raid saunas and underground bars and clubs. More than 80 people have reportedly been arrested so far this year for the crime of being gay.
The global LGBT communities and its allies are reeling over the gruesome assassinations this week of Bangladeshi journalists and activists Julaz Manan and Tonoi Mahbub by a gang of at least six Islamic fundamentalists. This report was posted on the Advocate website on April 26th.
Al-Qaeda subsidiary Ansar al-Islam has claimed responsibility for the hacking death of two LGBT rights activists in Bangladesh. One of the victims was the editor of Rupvan, the country's only LGBT magazine. A Twitter message was posted by the group claiming the attacks. The message said the two were killed because they were pioneers of practicing and promoting homosexuality in Bangladesh and were working day and night to promote homosexuality.
The 39-year-old Manan, the editor of Rupvan magazine, also worked for USAID, the U.S. government agency responsible for foreign aid. The 25-year-old Mahbub was a college student and also worked on the magazine. A third activist in Manan's Dhaka apartment reportedly survived the horrific assaults. The murders are the latest in a series of attacks against secular journalists, bloggers, and academics by radical Islamist groups in the South Asian nation. One anonymous for obvious reasons Bangladeshi blogger called Manan his country's Harvey Milk. According to the Pink News website, local police have detained two college students and claim to have found some important evidence in connection with the vicious murders. Some of the killers are believed to have posed as couriers to gain access to the building.
In U.S. news this week, Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Haslam signed a bill allowing counselors and therapists to refuse to serve clients based on sincerely held principles. An earlier version of the bill had allowed counselors to refuse service to patients based on religious belief, but it was amended to remove any direct reference to religion. Haslam said in a statement that, "I believe it is reasonable to allow these professionals to determine if and when an individual would be better served by another counselor better suited to meet his or her needs." The American Counseling Association said the bill violates its code of ethics and, like similar measures promoting discrimination and so-called religious freedom across the country, clearly targets LGBT people. But the Family Action Council of Tennessee, which opposes LGBT rights and supported the bill, denied the allegation.
In better news for sexual minorities, a religious freedom bill died in the Missouri legislature this week. Senate Joint Resolution 39 would have made it legal for clergy and vendors to decline to participate in a wedding involving a gay or lesbian couple. Because the vote was a 6-6 tie, it lost in the House Emerging Issues Committee on April 27th. Three Republicans joined the three Democratic members of the committee to scuttle the proposal. Minority Democrats staged the longest filibuster in state Senate history in March before the bill was advanced by that GOP-dominated chamber by a vote of 23-7. If it had passed both houses of the Missouri legislature, the measure would have gone on the ballot for a popular vote.
And finally, in the capital of Mormon-majority Utah, The Salt Lake City Council voted unanimously on April 20th to rename a downtown street for gay martyr Harvey Milk. In 1977, Milk became the first openly gay person ever elected to public office in California. He'd only been a San Francisco supervisor for 11 months when he was brutally murdered by former supervisor Dan White. A stretch of 900 South in Salt Lake City is now officially Harvey Milk Boulevard. The global headquarters of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is just a few miles down the road. The LGBT rights group Equality Utah, which lobbied the council for the name change, has launched a campaign to raise the $7,000 to $9,000 that'll be needed for the new Harvey Milk Boulevard street signs.
Every gay person must come out. You must tell your immediate family. You must tell your relatives. You must tell your friends, if indeed they are your friends. You must tell your neighbors. You must tell the people you work with. You must tell the people in the stores you shop in. And once you do, you will feel so much better.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 30th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
North Carolina, friendly mountain breezes, North Carolina, with its sandy beaches, wonderland of variety. Coast to mountains, it's great to be right here in North Carolina. Love the pines around in North Carolina. Get your cares behind you, living is right in holiday bright, North Carolina.
Another week has gone by, and the hate pot continues to boil over in North Carolina. HB2 bans local governments from protecting LGBT people from discrimination and requires transgender people to use public bathrooms, restrooms, or other sex-segregated facilities based on their birth gender rather than their gender identity. LGBT activists and their allies staged a civil disobedience action at the state capitol in Raleigh on April 26th to protest the law. Pacifica Radio's Gabriela Castellón reports.
Officers arrested 54 protesters who came to voice opposition to the law. Three dozen of them refused to leave the building after it was officially closed, and Capitol Police warned that they faced arrest.
If you do not leave right now, then you're going to be placed under arrest.
Woo!
I don't.
Whose house is it?
Opponents of the law have delivered 187,000 signatures demanding its repeal. Reverend William Barber referred to the law as Hate Bill 2 at the protest.
Hate Bill 2 is not a bathroom bill.
That's right.
It is not a bill to protect women and children from predators.
That's right.
It is a cynical attempt to pit supposedly Christian values against our family's best interests and our faith's highest morality.
Yeah.
Earlier in the day, thousands of Christian conservatives and other supporters of the law known as House Bill 2 gathered to praise the mostly Republican lawmakers and Governor Pat McCrory for passing the restrictions last month in a special session.
U.S. President Barack Obama had to address his country's seeming obsession with bathrooms at a Q&A with a mostly student audience last week during his visit to the U.K.
I'm about to do something terrifying, which is I'm coming out to you as a non-binary person, which means that I don't fit within... I'm getting emotional. I'm so sorry. Because... I'm from a Pakistani Muslim background, which inevitably has cultural implications. And I know that in North Carolina recently with the bathroom bill, people are being forced to obviously produce birth certificates to prove their gender in order to go to the toilet. In the UK, we don't recognise non-binary people under the Equality Act, so we literally have no rights. So if there was any discrimination, there's nothing we can do. And I really, really wish that yourself and David Cameron would take us seriously as transgender people, and perhaps you could elucidate as to what you can do to go beyond what has been accepted as the LGBTQ rights movement in including people who fit outside the social norms.
Well, look, I think that I'm incredibly proud of the steps it sounds like you've already taken to speak out about your own experience and then to try to create a social movement and change laws. It sounds to me like you're on the right track. I can't speak for David Cameron, although I will say that on LGBT issues, I think David's been ahead of the curve relative to a lot of other leaders around the world and even here in the UK. I can say from my perspective that we're taking a lot of serious steps to address these issues within the federal government. The challenge we've had is North Carolina, the law that comes up, for example. That's a state law, and because of our system of government, I can't overturn on my own state laws unless a federal law is passed that prohibits states from doing these things. And with the Congress I currently have, that's not likely to happen. But we're doing a lot of work administratively. And as I said, you should feel encouraged just by virtue of the fact that I think social attitudes on this issue have changed faster than I've seen on any other issue. It doesn't feel fast enough for you or for those who are impacted, and that's good. You shouldn't feel satisfied. You should keep pushing. But I think the trend lines are good on this. We're moving in the right direction, and in part because of courageous and active young people like yourself. So stick with it.
That was President Barack Obama in the UK with some words of encouragement for Pakistani trans woman Maura Munir.
Step to the left, now step to the right. Put your knees together and squeeze them tight. Keep your arms moving side to side. Try to hold it in till it's time to ride. Knock, knock, let me in, knock, knock, let me in, I gotta go, knock, knock, let me in, knock, knock, let me in, I gotta go.
Not surprisingly, both Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have called for the repeal of HB2. Republican presidential wannabe Donald Trump seemed to flip-flop on the issue during the week, while rival Ted Cruz milked it for all it was worth.
Mr. Trump, please be specific. Tell us your views on LGBT, how you plan to be inclusive as president. Speak about North Carolina bathroom law in particular.
Oh, I had a feeling that question was going to come up. I will tell you. Well, look, North Carolina did something that was very strong, and they're paying a big price, and there's a lot of problems. And I heard one of the best answers I heard was from a commentator yesterday saying, leave it the way it is right now. There have been not very few problems. Leave it the way it is. North Carolina, what they're going through with all of the business that's leaving and all of the strife, and it's on both sides. You leave it the way it is. There have been very few complaints the way it is. People go, they use the bathroom that they feel is appropriate. There has been so little trouble, and the problem with what happened in North Carolina is the strife and the economic punishment that they're taking. So I would say that's probably
the best
way.
People working in your organization?
I don't know.
No?
I really don't know. I probably do. I really don't know.
So if Caitlyn Jenner were to walk into Trump Tower and want to use the bathroom, you would be fine with her using any bathroom she chooses?
That is correct.
Okay.
Different issue, also a social issue.
You know, there's a big move to create new bathrooms. Problem with that is for transgender. That would be first of all, I think that would be discriminatory in a certain way. It would be unbelievably expensive for businesses and for the country. Leave it the way it is.
This morning, Donald Trump went on the Today Show. He was talking with Matt Lauer and palling around with his buddies in the media. Donald agreed with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in attacking the state of North Carolina for passing their bathroom ordinance. And Donald on television this morning said, gosh, he thought that men should be able to go into the girls' bathroom if they want to. Now, let me ask you, have we gone stark raving nuts? This is the political correctness. This is basic common sense. Let me ask you, are there any parents of daughters here? I'm the father of two little girls. Here is basic common sense. Grown adult men, strangers, should not be alone in a bathroom with little girls.
I think that local communities and states should make the decision, and I feel very strongly about that. The federal government should not be involved.
And let me point out, listen, every one of us has the right to live our lives as we wish. If any one of us wants to dress up as a woman or man, wants to live as a woman or man, believes that we might be something other than what we were born, you know, God has made each of us with free will and the ability to choose to do it. If a man wants to dress as a woman and live as a woman and to have a bathroom at home,
so then they shouldn't use the bathroom out in public?
You don't have a right to intrude upon the rights of others, because whether or not a man believes he's a woman, there are a lot of women who would like to be able to use a public restroom in peace without having a man there and when their children involved.
Amen.
You don't have a right to impose your lifestyle on others.
Meanwhile, it became clear this week that the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, is not going to hold major athletic tournaments, such as the fabled basketball Final Four, in states like North Carolina if they discriminate against any student athlete or fan. NCAA Board of Governors Chair Kirk Schultz.
We need to make sure our student athletes are competing in venues and competing in states that have an inclusive environment for all of our student athletes, our fans, and our coaches. It's important for us to weigh in on these important issues and make sure that regardless of whether our student is a Division I, Division II, or Division III athlete, that their championship experience is among the best.
Ted Cruz kept pushing what rival Trump has dubbed his Lion Ted campaign in support of HB2 during a May 1st appearance on NBC's Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory inexplicably continued to defend the law during an interview with Megyn Kelly on Fox News.
Caitlyn Jenner actually took Trump up on his offer, and she went and used the bathroom in Trump Tower and then tweeted about it. And she said, by the way, Ted, referring to you, nobody got molested. What do you say to Caitlyn Jenner?
What I say is very simple. If you pass a law, as Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and Barack Obama want, that says any adult man can go into a girl's restroom if he feels like a woman at that minute, people who are predators use that law as an excuse to go target our kids. And that is a real dangerous. I've spent a lot of years in law enforcement dealing with cases of some of the very worst child molesters, people who do horrible things to kids.
You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got trouble, and I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, see it through, 'cause you've got a friend in me. You got a friend in me.
I can't believe we're talking about this. This is not an issue that I started. This is an issue that the left started, not the right.
Specifically, what was the evidence that led you to believe this was a problem?
It wasn't. It was a respect for privacy. It was an expectation of privacy that individuals have, especially our youth have, when they go into a locker room, a shower, or a restroom. And it's not just women's bathroom, it's boys' bathrooms. And in fact, the Obama administration now is putting requirements on state, on federal money given to states that they also have to have this gender identification requirement for our schools. And what we ought to do is for those people who have these unique gender identification issues, which I empathize with, mm-hmm. we ought to allow the schools to make special arrangements for those people.
Oh, my.
Late night talk show hosts are, of course, still enjoying a field day with North Carolina's HB2. On NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers, the former Saturday Night Live Weekend Update anchor proposed a new TV crime drama spinoff, and Stephen Colbert on CBS's The Late Show made it personal.
There are any number of problems with these laws, and aside from the fact they're hateful and discriminatory, they're also unenforceable. When asked how they would enforce the North Carolina law, a spokesperson for one local police department said, "So that means people have to go to the bathroom with birth certificates? Yeah, that was curious to me." And another said, "We don't have police officers sitting at public bathrooms all day long. But it'd be cool if you did, because then there could be a new Dick Wolf spinoff, Law and Order, Someone's in Here."
If you've been following the news, you know that there are a lot of new laws out there, like one down in North Carolina, which are regulating which bathrooms transgender people are allowed to use. And, I mean, this is huge news. Even the candidates are talking about it. And now a protest group has collected 750,000 pledges to boycott the store Target over their policy of welcoming transgender people to use whichever bathroom matches their personal identity. Well, here's where I stand. I know you want to know where I stand on this one. Here's the thing. I don't care if you're male or female, what sex or gender identity someone is. I, and I mean this sincerely, do not want to share a bathroom with anyone. Okay? For two reasons. Number one, and number two. And to all those lawmakers out there who are so obsessed with who's using what bathroom and what plumbing they got downtown, newsflash, you're the weirdos.
And the beat goes on.
Yes, the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on.
The beat goes on.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V and Wenzel Jones contributed program material with thanks to Gabriella Castellone and the Pacifica Evening News, and as always, to Steve Pride. Teen Titans' Randy Newman and Sonny and Cher performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Prentham, our contributing affiliate stations, with special thanks this week to the staff and volunteers at WMPG in Portland, Maine, and to you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our must-have LGBT history from Outlaws to In-Laws CD, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WEFT Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, 3UGE Alexandra, Victoria, KDVS Davis, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Species are going extinct at an alarming rate. Why is this, and how should we respond? Is it human nature to act in ways that destroy habitats and eliminate whole species from existence? Or are structural forces to blame? And what should we make of efforts to respond to the extinction crisis, efforts that include rewilding and even bringing back extinct species? Ashley Dawson considers these and other questions in a new book that examines capitalism's role in what's called the sixth mass extinction. Ashley Dawson is professor of English at both the City University of New York Graduate Center and the College of Staten Island, CUNY. He's edited books about pro-Palestinian activism, the global justice movement, and academic freedom under neoliberalism. His new book is Extinction, A Radical History. When Ashley Dawson joined me in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I began by asking him how bad the extinction crisis we face today is.
It's very bad. Conservation biologists are able to track the rate of extinction as against speciation, that is the evolution of new species. And so they say that we're losing about 100 species a day, and that over the last 40 years or so, we've lost roughly 50% of the flora and fauna on the planet. So it's really one of the most significant aspects of the contemporary environmental crisis. It doesn't tend to get quite as much attention as climate change and the climate crisis more broadly, but I think it's an intimate part of that. For instance, one of the prime drivers of extinction is habitat destruction, and particularly the destruction of tropical rainforests, which is where a lot of biodiversity is concentrated on the planet. Of course, we also know that if you chop down rainforests, you're getting rid of the lungs of the planet, one of the great sources of carbon sink on the planet. So extinction crisis is a very important part of a much broader set of crises and sort of thresholds that the planet is going through. It's not quite as visible and doesn't have quite as much political mobilization, I think, as the climate crisis. But I think in some ways it's equally important and perhaps resonates with us. I mean, think about the way in which in cultures across the globe, people feel a very visceral connection to animals and often get a kind of sense of identity through their links to animals, their imaginative links to animals. So there's a way in which the extinction crisis really hits at what it means to be human because it's decimating these life forms that are so close to us in a much more kind of tangible way than the climate crisis, which has to do with something quite intangible, you know, atmospheric carbon concentrations.
100 species go extinct each day. I mean, that is astonishing. How does that rate compare to previous times?
It's much, much higher. So one of the points that I want to make in my book is that there have been previous episodes of extinction. Of course, there have been previous mass extinctions in the history of the planet. The one that most people know about is the extinction of the dinosaurs when an asteroid fell and hit the planet and wiped out the dinosaurs and most other species on Earth. But what we're looking at now is the sixth great extinction event in the history of the planet. And so one of the things that I try and do in the book is to periodize that extinction a little bit. And I talk about some of the important waves of extinction that are part of the sixth extinction. I talk about the destruction of megafauna in the late Pleistocene epoch before the Neolithic Revolution when cities and quote-unquote civilization was formed. And so basically humans spread out across the planet and ate their way down the food chain, destroying a lot of big animals in that period. Then the next period when there was a lot of destruction was after the Neolithic Revolution, when you see empires being formed. So in the book, I talk about the Sumerian Empire, and in particular, I discuss the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the first works of literature ever created, which essentially describes deforestation that the Sumerian Empire carried out in the Middle East. And with that deforestation, there was also a great deal of what's called defaunation, a lot of destruction of the animal life that lived in those forests. So I talk about those kind of pre-modern, ancient forms of destruction of species. But the argument of my book is that this wave of extinction that comprises the sixth extinction really takes off with the advent of imperialism and capitalism about 500 years ago. And that's when you have the what's called the Columbian Exchange, when Europeans bring a lot of invasive species, you know, new kinds of animals and plant life to the New World and decimate a lot of the existing life forms in the New World. And of course, they're kind of genocidal enterprises going on as well that involve a lot of destruction of human beings as well as other life forms at that time. And it's just sped up since then, culminating in the really astonishing rates of extinction that you mentioned a second ago of 100 species a day at the moment.
Who or what does Elizabeth Colbert tell us in her best-selling prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, which has the subtitle An Unnatural History, unlike your book, A Radical History? Your book is entitled Extinction, A Radical History. What does Colbert blame for the current mass extinction crisis, the sixth extinction, mass extinction?
Well, Colbert's book is a really important overview of what's happening at the moment and of the kind of rates of extinction that are going on. But the problem that I have with her book is that she tends to blame the sixth extinction on a kind of undifferentiated humanity. So close to the end of her book, she says, if you want to think about why humans are so dangerous to other species, you can picture a poacher in Africa carrying an AK-47 or a logger in the Amazon gripping an axe, or better still, you can picture yourself holding a book in your lap. Close quote. And, you know, when I read that quotation, my jaw sort of dropped because while I appreciated her effort to make her readers think about their culpability for extinction rates, and obviously particularly in North America where we consume so many resources, so many global resources, we are very much culpable, I think the problem is that she blames extinction on a kind of undifferentiated humanity, and by doing that doesn't really get at the kinds of disparities in rates of consumption and rates of responsibility, and essentially puts forward a kind of hopeless argument, you know, that there's something about humanity which is flawed that's leading to this. You know, maybe it's the structure of our brains or some such thing. And so I want to try and give an analysis which gets at the underlying structure that drives extinction. And that analysis has to do with industrial capitalism and its drive to expand at ever greater rates on a finite planet. And also to do with the way in which that expansion benefits some people and not others. So I very much want to take to task her undifferentiated picture of who's responsible for extinction.
And we'll certainly delve into the role of capitalism in producing and generating the current mass extinction crisis. I want to, at this point, move to, and we agreed to talk specifically about a chapter in your book, the book, again, Extinction, A Radical History, written by my guest, Ashley Dawson. And that chapter actually is called Anti-Extinction, and it begins with what U.S. government policy has been in relation to wilderness and the protection of wildlife. So we have the Federal Wilderness Act. It was enacted in 1964. What approach did it take?
The idea of the wilderness preservation, which really goes back to the progressive era in the late 19th century and early 20th century, but was consolidated in the second wave of environmentalism in the 60s and 70s, was to set aside land and keep it inviolate in some sense while development went on full bore all around that set aside land. Well, there are a couple of problems with that. First of all, the land wasn't entirely untouched, right? The way it was defined initially in the progressive era was that it could be set aside, but that conservation would involve sort of sustainable use of the land. And so on a lot of federal lands, as I'm sure your listeners know, there's a great deal of logging that takes place, a great deal of mineral extraction, and most recently a lot of fracking that goes on. So it wasn't really completely set aside. But the second problem, and this for me is a much more basic one, was that setting aside certain areas doesn't really get at the systemic nature of the crisis. And even more, when you try to create a little island of biodiversity, biologists have shown that, in fact, biodiversity gradually diminishes. You just need spaces that are quite big, and you need to be able to have species moving from one space to another. So the whole model of preserving the sort of isolated capsule of intact nature while you have the rest of the planet being developed full bore doesn't make sense on any kind of level.
Yeah, Rob Nixon, who teaches at Princeton, he's referred to what he sees as a parochialism within conservation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he's thinking in the context of Africa, and the way that conservation began as a movement of colonial powers to protect land which was set aside, you know, often for big game hunting by white imperial functionaries. And so in order to set that land aside and conserve the species that lived there, indigenous people, the colonized, had to be pushed out. And of course, they'd been the husbands of that biodiversity, you know, the preservers of that biodiversity for many, many centuries. So you would set aside a space and say you're going to conserve it, then come in and mow down a lot of the wildlife and keep it at a certain level, but, you know, engage in sort of wholesale slaughter. So there's a real kind of parochialism there. But it's not just parochialism, it's also racism and violence. And so it's important to think about these policies of conservation in terms of the way that they create conservation refugees.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Ashley Dawson is professor of English both at the City University of New York Graduate Center and the CUNY College of Staten Island, and his new book is Extinction, A Radical History. It's just out from OR Books. So that, you know, we have extinction, and then we have this term and this concept. It's called rewilding. So where did that term originate, and what does it mean?
Rewilding, the place that I'm most familiar with it is from the work of George Monbiot, who has a wonderful book. He's a British journalist. He has a wonderful book about rewilding. But it's really a product of unorthodox strategies among conservation biologists. And it's most associated with policies of reintroducing wolves into parks in the United States, like Yellowstone. And this was a very controversial policy initially, and this has to do with the whole history of imperialism and colonization. So when white settler colonial people were taking over the West, one of the first things that they did was to exterminate a lot of the wolf populations, because the wolves would prey on their cattle. So to reintroduce the wolf brings up a lot of concerns and fears about the role of the wolf. But what happened when biologists tried to do that, and the idea was, well, we want to take these parks back beyond the settler colonial moment, back to the period that they existed in prior to the advent of European domination. So we should, you know, make the ecosystems look as much like they used to look, and reintroduce the wolves. And what became evident was that when you reintroduce predators like the wolves, they would prey on species further down the food chain, like elk and other large herbivores. And by doing that, they'd help to bring back a lot of flora, you know, trees and bushes and other things, which would bring back bird life. And so there'd be what Monbiot calls a trophic cascade, where you'd suddenly have a lot more biodiversity appearing. And so this became quite an inspiration as a policy, and has been taken up in various different places, including in Holland, where there's an attempt to reintroduce some of the ancestors of the ox, which existed in pre-Neolithic times in Europe. And so it's really an attempt to sort of take ecosystems and turn the clock back and bring them back to the conditions, the kind of wild conditions they were in before modern European colonial civilization transformed them.
And so just to be clear, so when the wolves that are reintroduced into these parks like Yellowstone, when they prey on elk, then there are fewer elk then to eat certain vegetation, which can then regenerate itself better. And that's how reintroducing these predator species can actually help other species that might not even be associated directly with the predator, in terms of, you know, it's not part of the predator-prey relationship.
Exactly. So it's turning out, actually, that top of the food chain predators play a very important role in transforming ecosystems. And this goes somewhat counter to the ideas of some environmentalists. You know, there's been a lot of criticism of the way in which the environmental movement focuses on so-called charismatic megafauna. You know, think about the polar bear, for instance, as a kind of icon to try and get people to do something against global warming. So people have tried, of course, to look at far less charismatic species. And, you know, it's important to think about things. I mean, climate change is potentially destroying a lot of microscopic life on the planet, you know, a lot of elements of the microbial world, which are in fact very essential to life on the planet. But having said that, it turns out that top predators, these charismatic predators like wolves, actually do play a very important role, and reintroducing them to some of these parks can help bring the parks back to a state of biodiversity that they hadn't been in previously.
Yeah, so we have been hearing a lot about climate change destabilizing habitats and thus prompting or forcing species to move over distances or even up slopes of hills and mountains. So what strategies have rewilding advocates come up with to address this?
I think that the idea of rewilding is to try and expand existing parks, set aside new areas, and to connect one parkland to another so that they're passageways. And by doing that, to make sure that there's enough exchange that biodiversity continues to grow and to be sustained. I think that there's some problems there. And one of the things that I do in my book in terms of a critique of rewilding is to point out that it's focused almost exclusively in wealthy countries. You know, it's a policy that's been adopted in parts of North America and Europe, while deforestation and defaunation goes forward in the global south, in tropical countries, post-colonial nations, almost unimpeded. So one of the points that I try to make is that it's a policy that is very much complicit with tourism, ecotourism, and is not thinking about global justice in a broader kind of lens. But then, as you say, another potential challenge to the idea of rewilding is that the climate is beginning to change so quickly that ideas of taking an ecosystem back to a pristine state before European colonization has lots of problems. For one thing, there is no pristine ecosystem. Prior to European colonization, Native Americans were transforming ecosystems in various different ways, usually living in a far more sustainable state than the colonists introduced. Nonetheless, there wasn't some sort of completely natural state prior to colonization. And so it's important to keep that in mind. But the other aspect, in addition to this idea of criticizing a kind of nostalgia for a natural past, is to raise the question of what's going to happen going forward and what some of the problems of ideas of rewilding might be. But biologists are really pushing these ideas quite a lot and are beginning to actually think about moving species from place to place. And there's a term called assisted colonization, which alludes to that idea. So they're very much departing from previous ideas about keeping an ecosystem intact and pristine.
Ashley Dawson joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ashley is professor of English at the City University of New York, both the Graduate Center and the College of Staten Island. His books include Mongrel Nation, Diasporic Culture and the Making of Post-Colonial Britain, and The Routledge Concise History of 20th Century British Literature. We are talking about his new book. It's called Extinction, A Radical History. It's published by OR Books. So, Ashley, you write that while some rewilders want to restore an area to a period before European settlement, as you said, others want to go back much further in time. How much further?
Well, very, very far back essentially to the period prior to the Neolithic Revolution and to an era prior to many of the extinctions of megafauna during the late Pleistocene that I mentioned at the outset. So one of the most radical kinds of suggestions, even more radical than rewilding, that some biologists are making is that what we really need is de-extinction or even regenesis. We need to bring back lost species and recreate them through genetic engineering and reintroduce them into rewilded habitats.
Well, tell us about this. So are you saying that genetic information about something that no longer exists can somehow be used or has been used to regenerate a species?
Yeah, exactly. It's been done once with an ibex, kind of mountain-dwelling goat, the last example of which was discovered shortly after she died in the Pyrenees in Spain.
So this was the last one of the species.
Yeah,
dies.
That's right. Dies. Scientists collect the genetic information and are able to kind of clone a new example into existence of this otherwise extinct species. And so what scientists are not able to do is, I mean, for instance, if they find some remnant of a woolly mammoth is the most kind of famous example that's gotten a lot of media attention. If they find some remnant of a woolly mammoth buried in the Siberian tundra, they'll be able to extract some genetic information from that woolly mammoth and then use the DNA of an elephant, of an existing elephant, and rejigger it using genetic engineering and then kind of clone it, put it into an elephant embryo and create some approximation of the woolly mammoth. It's never going to be exactly the original woolly mammoth, but the idea is you're going to get something quite close to that. And there are organizations such as the Bay Area-based Revive and Restore, which are trying to bring back not just the woolly mammoth, but many other extinct species, including the passenger pigeon, for example.
And before we talk more about de-extinction, I want to ask you about the Pleistocene Park. This was established in 1989 in Siberia. Tell us about this venture, this adventure.
Yeah, so it's the attempt by a Russian biologist to create a space where animals that are quite similar to Pleistocene-era animals, oxen, for instance, could be reintroduced and by bringing them back into that landscape could actually help to establish the possibility for the successful ultimate reintroduction of woolly mammoths and other similar animals. And the argument is that by moving that landscape back into a previous kind of times in history, that it's going to stem some of the effects of global warming, most importantly the melting of the tundra and the potential release of methane gases.
So what would Pleistocene rewilding in the U.S. involve?
Well, at the moment, a lot of it has to do with taking wildlife that exists predominantly in Africa and bringing it to the United States. So particularly elephants, for instance, right? Those are the sort of closest charismatic megafauna that we can imagine to the woolly mammoths and other top predators and herbivores. And so it again brings up some of the kinds of questions that we talked about before about the history of empire and the ways in which conservation was very much complicit with colonialism and the destruction of landscapes in the global south. So what would it mean to create a park in the United States by exporting a lot of elephants from Africa?
So on the issue of de-extinction, back to that issue, I mean, what's your assessment of this focus on genetic information, using that to resurrect extinct species? I mean, the conceptual work being done in that arena and what it might do to our understanding or our ability to address an extinction crisis and an environmental crisis in a healthy, productive way.
I feel quite critical about it. I mean, I think that there's a very basic problem, and that is that scientists are far better at the moment at tinkering around with genetic substance than they are with actually saving endangered environments, notwithstanding attempts to rewild. And so if you recreate something like the passenger pigeon, not to mention the woolly mammoth, the question is, where are you going to put them? You might have a park in Siberia where it's possible to have them live for some time. But, you know, the passenger pigeon once roamed quite freely throughout the United States, and it died because a lot of its habitat got destroyed as a result of urbanization. So we've really transformed environments to the point where the idea of bringing a species back and putting it back in a radically transformed environment doesn't make very much sense. But then I also have another critique of this, and it is that it seems to me that we're entering into a kind of moment of biocapitalist experimentation, which is really unprecedented. Even though there was a lot of hype about the decoding of the genome about 10 years ago, it really didn't lead to a great deal of medical advancement and a lot of practical outcomes. But the science has progressed so much, it seems to me we're on the threshold of a lot of ethically and politically questionable transformations. And so what I do in the book is to set these quite, you know, exciting and interesting ideas about de-extinction in this broader political economic context where we have these new technologies which could be used not just to bring back passenger pigeons, but also to transform the human genome. And this is heritable human genetic material. So what would it mean for questions of social justice to be deploying these technologies? What I argue is that de-extinction essentially normalizes these technologies, gets us used to them in a venue that seems quite attractive and probably not quite as ethically problematic, but that it kind of opens the door to much more questionable practices.
Yeah, and I want to ask you more about this sort of biocapitalist world order that you're talking about. After a short break, Ashley Dawson, he teaches English at the City University of New York, and his new book is Extinction, A Radical History. Please join us after the break. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ashley Dawson teaches English at the City University of New York, both the Graduate Center and the College of Staten Island. And he is a member of the editorial collective of the journal Social Text. He's written a number of books, including Mongrel Nation, Diasporic Culture, and the Making of Postcolonial Britain. And we are focusing today on his new book. It's called Extinction, A Radical History. We have information and links about and to Ashley Dawson on our website, againstthegrain.org. So de-extinction has this focus on genetic information as a way of revivifying, resurrecting extinct species. And you have this critique of biocapitalism in your book. And this goes to the way capitalist firms are approaching genetic information and want to use genetic information. Maybe we could start with the trends you identify over the past several decades, the trends followed by or initiated by the U.S. pharmaceutical and petrochemical industries. What have they been doing that we should know about?
Yeah, well, they used to make their money in the era of the Green Revolution when they were exporting a lot of fertilizer and pesticides to the developing world through pretty straightforward chemical technology and innovations. But what happened in the period sort of around the 1970s, by the 1970s, was that developing countries had developed the capacity to manufacture their own Green Revolution era technologies and chemicals and pesticides. So we see big corporations beginning to make a shift into the biological sciences and into the exploration of genetic engineering. And there's a big institutional change that happens in this time, and one of the kind of landmark changes that facilitates this is the passage of the Bayh-Dole Act in 1980. And what that does is to essentially allow the patenting of genetically engineered organisms. So, you know, if a scientist creates something new using genetic engineering, instead of it being public property, it becomes patentable and it becomes the property of the individual scientist and or her or his institution. So that really facilitates this shift and facilitates a great deal of capital investment in new genetic engineering technologies. And this is when we get corporations like Monsanto going into genetically modified crops in a very, very strong way.
Naomi Klein came up with the term disaster capitalism. You bring up the term disaster biocapitalism to refer to what?
Well, so disaster biocapitalism is about the way in which essentially we're looking at an extinction crisis, a great disaster of planetary magnitude. And what capital is doing is taking this as an opportunity for a new round of accumulation. So I'm essentially arguing that this shift into new forms of genetic engineering is a form of disaster capitalism, but it's specifically biocapitalism because it comes through the shift of capital into these new genetic engineering technologies and into the creation of novel organisms of all sorts, potentially.
Can we at least be comforted by the fact, if it is true, that environmental organizations have not signed on to the biocapitalist agenda, the disaster biocapitalism that you refer to?
Would that that were true, yes. Unfortunately, it's really not. Many of the big conservation organizations actually see this disaster biocapitalism as a way to go forward. They may not necessarily be involved in the genetic engineering, but the idea is to use these processes of commodification to establish or to support biodiversity. So in the book, I talk about the UN-organized reforestation initiative. The acronym is REDD, UN Red. And the idea behind that initiative is to essentially stop habitat destruction, particularly destruction of tropical rainforests, by paying countries in the global south not to chop those rainforests down. Where does the money come from? Well, it comes from polluting corporations in the global north. What I argue, though, and I'm drawing very much on experiences I've had with activists in the climate justice movement, what I argue is that the problem with something like UN Red is that it allows polluting corporations in the global north to go on polluting, so it doesn't fundamentally transform an unsustainable capitalist system. And what happens in the global south is that when leaders of countries get told that they're going to get a bunch of money for not chopping down the rainforest, in most cases, they see ways to make money out of that, and they give concessions to big logging and other resource extraction companies, most of which are based in the global north. Those companies come in, they clear cut the rainforest, they push indigenous and forest-dwelling peoples out. Those people often don't have, they have sort of traditional land title. They don't have any kind of established forms of ownership which are recognizable in international legal terms. So they get pushed out and become conservation refugees, continuing this kind of long history of pushing people out. And these big corporations come in, they clear-cut the rainforests, and then set up plantations of fast-growing forests like eucalyptus trees, for instance. And those really aren't sustainable. They absorb a lot of water from the aquifers, and eventually they fall down and rot because there aren't people to really manage them. So it's not really a viable option. And UN Red is the kind of paradigm which the United Nations is using to try and support biodiversity more broadly. So the idea across the board is that we're going to commodify biodiversity, pay countries in various different ways for keeping it alive, and get the money from these polluting corporations in the global north and allow them to keep polluting and doing that.
Ashley Dawson, professor of English at the CUNY Graduate Center, that's the City University of New York, and English professor and chairperson of the English department at the College of Staten Island, CUNY. And his new book is Extinction, A Radical History. It's published by OR Books. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I'd like to return to what we discussed briefly at the beginning of this hour, which was the contention made by Elizabeth Colbert, and, you know, no doubt a lot of folks out there, given the, of course, popularity of her book, The Sixth Extinction, that it's something innate in humans that is leading us down this terrible path of environmental degradation and mass extinction. And, you know, what's your best argument that industrial capitalism is really to blame? And that is really one of the main focuses of this book. What is it about capitalism that makes it so much easier for all these species, all these life forms to be eliminated in such a rapidly increasing rate?
So I talk about three basic mechanisms that characterize capitalism and that make it particularly destructive environmentally and particularly responsible for extinction. The first is the fact that capitalism is based on ceaseless expansion on a finite resource base. You know, we live in a finite planet. Capitalism expands at a compound rate and is running through the planet at an increasing rate. So that's the first characteristic. The second characteristic is that capitalism relentlessly degrades the conditions which it depends upon for its own existence. And of course, I'm thinking most of all about the environmental conditions and particularly about the flora and fauna of the planet. And the third characteristic is that capitalism generates an increasingly chaotic world system, a system particularly of nation states warring against one another and inter-imperial competition. So what I do in the book is to go through each of these three characteristics of capitalism and give some examples of how it happens. So, for instance, in terms of the idea of expansion of capitalism, I talk about whaling, which really took off in the 19th century in tandem with the growth of industrial capitalism. And whaling was a highly kind of capital-intensive and highly industrialized process. You know, there are these huge factory ships which roved around the planet and would hunt species to the brink of extinction. And yet what I sort of point out in the book is that there was a denial process built into people's perception of this. I quote Herman Melville from Moby Dick, where his protagonist in the novel is speculating on why there are fewer whales in the ocean. And he's pushed to basically justify the system somehow, to say, well, actually, if it seems that there are fewer whales, it must be because whales are gathering into bigger schools and they're swimming further away to places like the Arctic. It isn't actually that we're decimating them and that the numbers of whales are diminishing and disappearing ultimately. So there are always a sort of self-justification process in place for capitalism to try and prevent recognition of these characteristics of destruction of the natural resource base that capitalism depends upon and the unsustainability of its tendency to grow infinitely.
And what about the role of science and the scientific method in generating conditions for the current wave of extinctions? Because I'm thinking, well, you are critical of certain kinds of science and the way science has been used historically to, in some instances, in many instances, degrade the environment. But is it fair to say also that we kind of need science in order to get ourselves out of the mess that we're in?
Well, I think that all too often science has been put at the behest of imperial expansion and capitalist exploitation of the planet. So I agree with you that we probably need science to get out of the mess that we're in, but I would argue that we need a kind of popular science. We need people's movements around science to create alternative forms of science. So, you know, I talk about the way in which science, you know, and particularly I quote some of Francis Bacon, one of the founders of the scientific method in the 17th century, who represented the way that science should behave as a kind of violent process of subjugating the world. And he uses quite gendered language. So, you know, the world is represented as a kind of female body that's going to be dominated and sort of lashed and taken apart by science in order to be reassembled. And so it's really these kind of violent processes that don't think holistically about systems. And so what I would argue is that science tends to break things apart and create the conditions for forms of environmental contradiction and blowback that come back to haunt science and the societies that it serves. And of course, the extinction crisis is one of the greatest examples of that. That said, though, I think there are many contrarian currents. In particular, you know, I would point to sort of movements for people science in the 1970s, which were challenging some of the forms of genetic engineering when they were initially being created. And I think that there's a parallel to that happening today, where people are trying to develop forms of DIY genetic engineering that are not going to be controlled by corporations. So it's a terrain of conflict constantly, I would say, but one that's structured by the domination of capitalism and of this project of expansion, which has created the current crisis.
What do you mean by DIY genetic engineering?
The idea, well, basically, current genetic technologies have gotten very cheap. And so there's a movement right now to create sort of people's labs where do-it-yourself genetic engineering is going to take place. And there are quite a few of these in the Bay Area, but they're growing up all around the United States. And I'm not a completely uncritical advocate of this. You know, I think to a certain extent, these are places where people are looking for a kind of killer biological app, just like people are looking for something in the world of software. So there are problems with it, but in the best instances, there are also attempts to use it to disseminate knowledge and know-how that are important potentially for the future. So, yeah, I don't want to be seen as someone who is sort of fundamentally against science and against scientific innovation, either in the past or in the present. I just think it's really important to have a kind of historical awareness of the problematic ways that science has been used and to be quite critical about what's happening on the ground at the moment today.
So, Ashley, you contend that the global north must foster degrowth to address and rein in our present expansionary capitalist system. So what are the contours in your mind of degrowth? What needs to happen in this regard?
Well, I try to draw on the climate justice movement, which has argued essentially that the global north, and particularly the global 1%, is responsible for the crisis we inhabit today, you know, and therefore owes a kind of debt to the peoples of the global south, and that this debt needs to be paid in various different ways. And one of the most important ways is that the economies of the global north need to contract. And when you talk about contraction, of course, it sounds terrible, but I think it's important to keep in mind that capitalism has created a lot of completely artificial needs, and that this process of contraction could actually be a salutary thing, and it could open new possibilities for human connection. In addition, of course, it will give space for a kind of convergence for forms of sustainable transformation in the countries of the global south. So I think that ideas of biodiversity debt have to be an important part of this argument that the climate justice movement is putting forward. And so that's what I try to add to these ideas.
Well, could we then contract capitalist economic systems, national capitalist systems? In other words, can capitalism be reformed in some way such that the dangers it poses to natural systems can be reduced or eliminated?
I don't believe that it can be. A lot of the conversation in my book about de-extinction and rewilding is essentially to say that while these movements potentially are interesting, they tend to suggest that green capitalism is something that's sustainable. And I believe that it's ultimately not sustainable, that what we really need is a transformation that goes beyond capitalism. And that's why I call my book Radical, A Radical History of Extinction. You know, I really want to talk about what the roots of the extinction crisis are. And I don't think we're going to be able to address the extinction crisis sufficiently through forms of green capitalism, which allow the continuous expansion of the current system. And so, you know, it seems hard to imagine ending the capitalist system. And at a certain point in the book, I mentioned the famous quotation by Frederick Jameson about it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. But what I would really say is that we're faced with the question of taking the destiny of the planet into our hands and not allowing it to continue to be dominated by this kind of irrational system of capitalism, which is driving us over a precipice. And I think if one puts it in those terms, it can seem less terrifying and less impossible. And of course, a lot of what I'm doing in the book is talking about the claims of environmental and climate justice as an essential part of that process of trying to think and make a rational society.
So one of the actions you call for in this book, Extinction, A Radical History, is the seizure of the assets of the large fossil fuel corporations. So who do you see doing the seizing, governments or people on a grassroots level?
I think that we have to have grassroots movements that are calling for this kind of seizure. So what I'm suggesting is that we need to push the divestment movement further, that we shouldn't just be thinking about divesting from fossil fuel corporations, that we actually need to be calling for a seizure of their assets. That seems quite improbable now, and it does bring up the question of where the political agency is going to be. But, you know, I think things are going to change very, very quickly. The divestment movement is moving from strength to strength. It's quite clear that we cannot have continued exploitation of fossil fuels. So I think we need to get the next set of demands on the table, and we need to be planning and calling for a kind of set of plans for a just transition to a different world. And we have to see these fossil fuel corporations that are so complicit in the planet-destroying conditions that we live in as on the hook for helping make that transition.
How important is it to your analysis to say that capitalism does not just physical violence to the natural world, but does a kind of conceptual violence to the natural world? And if that's part of the gist of this book, can you talk about the conceptual damage that capitalism, with the aid of certain scientists and certain sciences, the kind of damage it does on that conceptual level?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of what I'm doing in the book is talking about the ways in which capitalism creates a world in which we can think of animals, plants, and also people as objects which we can commodify and put at our disposal. So, I mean, I think one of the most chilling examples of this is the way in which colonized peoples and enslaved peoples were often analogized to animals. They're often described as animals. And when that happened, the colonizers were able to treat them in whatever way they wanted to, including committing genocide or, enslaving colonized peoples. So there's a kind of sense in which the flora and fauna of the world are the kind of absolute other that we feel fit to dominate and exploit in the most ruthless ways, and that then transforms how we treat one another, human beings, and impoverishes our relation to one another and allows these absolutely horrendous forms of behavior that have marked the era of extinction.
Ashley Dawson is his name. He's professor of English both at the City University of New York Graduate Center and the College of Staten Island. His books include The Routledge Concise History of 20th Century British Literature and Mongrel Nation, Diaspora Culture and the Making of Postcolonial Britain. And we have been talking about his new book. It's called Extinction, A Radical History. It's just out from OR Books. Ashley, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you so much, C.S.
And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find audio, resources, and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
Do you like the quote? Did you know it was
sure.
Mussolini?
It's okay to know it's Mussolini. Look, Mussolini was Mussolini. It's okay to know. It's a very good quote. It's a very interesting quote. And I know it. I saw it. I saw what, and I know who said it. But what difference does it make whether it's Mussolini or somebody else?
You want to be associated with a fascist?
No, I want to be associated with interesting quotes.
Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. Don't just sit there on your ass and look that funky chain dance. Brothers, sisters, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
Will you unequivocally condemn David Duke and say that you don't want his vote or that of other white supremacists in this election?
Well, just so you understand, I don't know anything about David Duke, okay? I don't know anything about what you're even talking about with white supremacy or white supremacists.
Would you just say, unequivocally, you condemn them and you don't want their support?
Well, I have to look at the group. I mean, I don't know what group you're talking about.
Okay, I mean, I'm just talking about David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan here, but...
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know David Duke. I don't believe I've ever met him. I'm pretty sure I didn't meet him. And I just don't know anything about him. White supremacy or white supremacist. 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 White supremacy or white supremacist.
White supremacy or white supremacist.
White supremacy or white supremacist.
White supremacy or white supremacist.
White supremacy or white supremacist.
White supremacy or white supremacist.
Fascist God in motion. Generals tell him what to do. Stop your good time dancing. Train the guns on me and you. Fascist gang advancing. Sisters, brothers, lend a hand. Increase our population. Grab that blue thing by the throat and throw it in the ocean. You're real tonight, you move my soul. Let's cruise on the dance floor. Come out your house and dance your dance. Shake that fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. I will build a wall, it'll be a great wall. Drugs will not pour through that wall.
We don't need that fascist groove thing.
You can say what you want about the Quran. You can say what you want. There's something there. Total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that.
than anybody.
They're fed up with those guys back there, the media. They are the worst.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters.
A total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
He's walking out like big high fives, smiling, laughing, like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
We never win. We just don't win.
We are going to make America great again.
Great again. Great again. Great again. Great again. Great again. Great again.